Can you call the roll?
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Sam Sharp?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Jeff Grover? Michael O'Neill? Lauren Klein?
Here.
Mandeep Dillon?
Here.
We have a quorum.
So we have a quorum. Any announcements?
I have a couple. As you noticed, Jamie Borba is sitting to my left today, which is not a usual situation. Kelly Gomes, the normal secretary to these meetings, her daughter is having a baby, I think pretty much as we speak. And unfortunately, her backup, Elaine, is experiencing some health issues at this moment right now. So we're kind of two down, and Jamie's stepping up to the plate here and helping us out today.
Thank you. Any other announcements? I noticed some people from the public are here. I'm required to read this statement. Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the board of retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment card, et cetera, et cetera. Are there any members from the public who would like to address the board? Okay, let's move on to the consent calendar.
Chairman, I'll move to adopt the consent calendar as I'll be posted on the agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is approved. The next item is the investment report.
Let's give these folks a chance to. Shut this down so you can't see me. This item is item 6A, functionally focused portfolio, the FFP annual reconciliation. Item 6A, this is a discussion and action item. And staff will be asking you today to maintain a 7-year shortfall immunization process, which is what we currently have, and transfer approximately $143 million from one of our managers, DFA, to our Insight fixed income manager on or around June 30th, 2018, with the actual transfer value to be based on a final valuation in mid-June. This FFP process, before we get started, runs on a fiscal year basis, and so as closest to the end of the fiscal year is when we have to fund this portfolio with Insight. And so I want to wait to the last possible moment to do a final valuation. You could have changes in interest rates, which is probably not going to affect it much. But more importantly, I'm in talks right now with our plan sponsors, the three biggest ones, the courts, Ceres, and the county, regarding payroll assumptions, hiring, and retiring practices right now, because that goes to our ability to project what payroll is going to be, which then helps us to project what our contributions are going to be, which is part of this shortfall process that we'll discuss. So right now it's about approximately, we're asking for a $143 million transfer. It may be more, it may be less, based on this final valuation that we do. So I've already talked about that. So what we're going to talk about today is, this is a reconciliation of our shortfall liabilities. We're going to show what caused the liabilities to change between valuation years, show why they changed, and then, like I said, ask for approval for this transfer. As I did this analysis over the last few weeks and I wrote this agenda item up, this is really kind of an actuarial process in a way. It's a reconciliation of liabilities, and it's a replenishment of funds to fund these liabilities. So it was it's a very interesting process that we went through to do this. So the idea behind the FFP is to be able to pay our benefits in any market environment. What you'll see is we invest assets in extremely riskless assets, or as riskless as we can get, and they don't react much to changes in market conditions, especially the equity markets. And so that gives us the ability to pay our benefits pretty much no matter what the market does between years. It eliminates the need to sell assets at the wrong time. If There's a liquidity crunch in the market, and we don't have enough liquidity to pay our benefits, then we might be forced to sell assets at just the wrong time. And that has happened before in my career. I've seen it happen before, so it's not always the case that I think a lot of times people assume that our pension funds always have a lot and enough liquidity. Most of the time we do, even without this process, but I have seen this hurt some pension systems in the past. And then also we can gain administrative efficiencies from this process, both operationally. The money essentially goes from our manager to our cash accounts. It's right there for us to pay benefits. We don't have to talk to the managers and decide who we're going to take money from to pay benefits. It's always there at the appropriate time. And then financially, our money is invested for as long as possible. These assets mature, or they pay coupons at a time that's close to when that money's needed to pay benefits. So it's financially efficient as well, because it reduces or eliminates cash drag on the portfolio. The desired outcome from the FFP is essentially we want to see little or no change in the funded status related to the shortfall liability. So we're going to look at both the assets and the liabilities that are dedicated to this process and look how they both changed over the course of the year to determine how the funded status changed relative to these liabilities, not the entire portfolio liabilities, but these. So this process is a microcosm of the entire pension plan, and theoretically, if interest rates were high enough, if we could earn our actuarial discount rate today based on a fixed income portfolio that gave that, we could theoretically immunize our liabilities and we'd have little or no change in the funded status from year to year. All benefits satisfied is another desired outcome, and then we want to take advantage of the illiquidity premium offered by alternative assets. And that is, since we've got our short-term cash flows covered for 7 years, that gives us the ability and the comfort to know that we can go outside of the norm a little bit and try to capture the liquidity premium that's inherent in some of the assets, real assets, private equity, private debt that we are currently investing in. So it gives us comfort that we don't have to tap those assets or sell them at an inopportune time. So the basics of the process is that staff each year around this time estimates our monthly benefit shortfalls. Our benefit shortfalls in this context could be described as the shortfall equals our benefits plus our expenses minus our contributions. So the shortfall equals our outgoes less our inflows, essentially, is what that is. The outflows equal the benefits and the expenses, contributions equal the inflows. Whatever the difference is a liability to the system. We actually don't have that cash on hand, so we have to devise efficient ways to get that cash on hand to pay our shortfalls. So what staff does each year, we project our benefits, we project our expenses, and we project our contributions. And what you'll see later on is that what's transpired over the year is exactly what we thought. Benefits and expenses are pretty easy to project over the period, but contributions can be somewhat tricky, because we can definitely capture trends in payroll and consequently contributions, but what we don't know is what our plan sponsors are going to do, any changes they're going to make in terms of hiring patterns, attrition, retirement incentives, stuff like that. We don't know that, and that stuff isn't inherent in past trends. So that's why currently I'm in conversations with Ceres, the county, and the courts about what they see their payroll trends doing over the next 2, 3 to 5 years. So then we come up with this projection matrix and we send it to the manager. The projection matrix last year was 7 years or 84 months of shortfalls. And then each month, right around the end of the month, the manager makes sure that the money's in our cash accounts and ready for us to pay our expenses, our benefits, and so forth. So this is an example of the shortfall matrix we sent to Insight last June. Insight didn't see the three middle columns. Of course, they don't really need to know what the component pieces are. And so Insight simply got a matrix that had two columns, month and shortfall. And then each month, at the end of the month, around the 27th or 28th, that number on the right-hand column was magically deposited in our cash accounts and was there and ready to pay benefits. So we'll talk about the shortfall liability, and then we'll go on to the assets, and then we'll look at them in tandem and decide whether the process worked this year. And then we'll finish up with our reconciliation of shoring that back up to 7 years. So the shortfalls are a liability to the system, just like our regular liabilities. We're responsible to pay those. And the contributions and the shortfall payments will ensure satisfaction of those liabilities. So you've heard the term market value of liability. Well, the way we treat this program, the shortfalls are a true market value of liability to the system. And the reason is because if one wishes to insure or immunize their liabilities, and they want to make sure that there's essentially a 0% chance of them not being paid, and if the system wants to remove any volatility related to the funded ratio, employer contribution rates, or the unfunded liability, then the appropriate way to do that would be to invest in a portfolio of assets that has essentially zero risk of default, zero sensitivity to market changes, and they pay benefits, or they pay coupons and mature at just about the same time as the benefits come due. And if you can do that, then essentially you're immunizing or you're insuring those shortfall liabilities, and they're essentially risk-free. The probability of you not being able to make those payments are essentially zero. And so if they're risk-free, if the probability is zero, then the correct theoretical way to discount those liabilities is to use a risk-free treasury curve or a spot curve, because those are assumed in financial literature and nomenclature. That is the asset that's assumed to be the risk-free asset. So you value these liabilities, you discount these shortfall liabilities, not the way we do our regular liabilities, which is using the actual discount rate. We discount them using the risk-free rate that we would get if we invested money in treasuries to fund these benefits. So that's how we're going to judge the value of this system and judge how well the process worked and how well the manager did later on. So this is an accounting of the shortfall assets. Assets are given to the manager to fund the shortfalls. We calculate the value of that shortfall liability using a risk-free treasury spot curve. And any assets in excess of liabilities at the point in time we give them to the manager is considered surplus. I would have loved it if we could have given the manager exactly the dollar amount that the shortfall liability was valued at, but that's really an impossibility. Plus, we needed to get up to $100 million to get a fee break from Insight. So essentially, we gave $100 million to Insight on or around June 30th. The value of that shortfall liability last year was $88.1 million. And so there was about an $11.9 million surplus in the fund, which means that the funded status of the assets and liabilities related to this program were about 113.5%. So we had about 113.5% of assets needed to fund the liability. We were overfunded, essentially. So with regard to the value that a manager may add to this program, I say this lightly, but all they have to do is give us the shortfall money each and every month that we ask them for it, and then beat a riskless treasury benchmark. And if they can do that, then they've added value to this program. If they've actually increased the funded status after being able to do that, then they've added value to the program. I know that Ed each month reports out essentially on an asset-only basis. And so when we look at Ed's numbers, we're looking at how they did relative to an asset-only benchmark. This is how they did relative to a liability benchmark. So there's a somewhat of a difference there in that approach. We'll look at how the manager added value over the course of the year. So you can read this chart both across from left to right and down from top to bottom. And the beginning value of the assets and liabilities, that's the same number as you saw on the first page. Both liabilities and assets were reduced by exactly the amount of shortfalls that they are giving us throughout this fiscal year. And there's a gain and loss due to changes in capital market conditions. What happened, especially in the interest rates and and so forth. And so here you can see that the losses on the both sides of the balance sheet, the liability and the assets, were very, very close. This is an indication that the manager is investing in such a way that's very close to the time when our liabilities come due. They're positioning their portfolio very similar to the way our liabilities and our cash flows are situated on the curve as well, the spot curve. And then you see the ending value down there. Now, it looks like we lost $1,787 in surplus. We did, but we started with more assets on the asset side than the liabilities. So we lost on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, the funded status increased because the assets decreased less than the liabilities did. The liabilities actually decreased at a greater rate relative than the assets did. That means our funded status increased. But this is a good example of how closely matched, again, that's the most important thing to take from this, is that how closely matched Insight's portfolio was with our liabilities. So they're doing pretty much what we've asked them to do. So this is a reconciliation of just the liability itself. So we started the year with 7 years of shortfalls, which had a market value of $88 million. Those liabilities went down because we simply paid them off. So they're no longer a liability on our books. They're done. We've defeased them. There's a gain or loss due to rolling down the curve. And that may sound foreign, but all that means is that the liabilities, those shortfall payments over the course of the year, they're getting 1 year closer to being paid. So they cost more money. The farther out a liability is, the less valuable it is, or the lower magnitude of a liability is on a present value basis. And as it continues to come closer and closer to being due, it becomes more burdensome and the liability value increases. So that's simply rolling down that liability curve and getting closer to the moment in time when they have to be paid and defeased. And then here's the big one here. So this is the change in interest rates. So the value of the remaining 6 years of shortfalls that's left after payment of our 1 year of shortfalls this year went down by $1.7 million, and that's because interest rates increased at the low end of the curve, which we all know that that's the case. So when interest rates increase, the value of the liabilities decrease. So that's what you're seeing there. And then what's left over is the 6 years of shortfalls, and that has a current value of $64 million. So now what we're asking you to do is let's figure out how much money we need to replenish that 7 year bucket to get it back up to 7 years, and then also to account for any changes in the assumptions that changed between last year and this year. And there was a big change. It's that $118 million we'll talk about on the next slide, but it's a huge change. So again, we need an increase to fund that new seventh year that shows up again. It was 8 years out, but we didn't immunize or insure 8 years of shortfall payments. Now it's 1 year closer, so that's our new seventh year. And then again, we have an increase or decrease due to the annual recalculation of those remaining shortfalls and trying to determine how much money. So in this case, you see that the new seventh year, costs an additional $36 million. But there's an increase due to the recalculation of the 6 years of shortfalls, and that costs $118 million. And when I saw that, I thought, what am I doing wrong? And so I started digging into it, and I quickly realized there's nothing I'm doing wrong. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. So what we're going to be asking you is to make sure that we shore up Insight's account before the beginning of the new fiscal year to $219 million. Now, let's find out why we had those changes. So, benefit payments. Staff actually underestimated benefit payments by $10 million. So, the remaining 6 years of benefit payments, which is a pretty good estimate, we realize that they're actually worth about $10.6 million more than what we thought last year. So we have to increase the shortfall projection, the liability, by $10 million. Staff overestimated expenses for the next 6 years, not by much, just by $1 million, so we adjusted that. So here's the big ones. Staff overestimated contributions over the next 6 years due to changes in payroll. And so after talking to the county and Ceres preliminarily, some of the changes that's going to occur at the county and Ceres with respect to payroll are causing us to rethink what our projections are for payroll and consequently contributions over the next 6 years, because contributions are the expected actuarial rate times payroll. So this is how much more money we need in this program to fund 7 years of shortfalls due to the fact that payroll expectations have changed over the from year to year.
So has it been going up or down, the expectation?
Payroll's going up.
So payroll is actually going down.
That's not possible.
It is possible.
Well, we've increased down.
Well, it is. I think that you probably need to go back and talk to some people to find out what's going on.
In our union contracts, the average person gets 3% raise.
Yes.
Plus we've increased
yes.
that by about 100 people. It's not possible for it to go down.
Well, relative to the payroll times the actuarial contribution rate, that number is not payroll, that $32 million. That's actually the contributions that's attributed to our payroll projections. So
Graham initially set it higher.
Well, that's coming next. This is just our projections of county and Ceres and court's payroll. And then we multiply that by the projected rates.
So what did we use when we initially projected payroll?
Last year?
That resulted in it being off by $32.6
million. Well, last year all we did was we looked at past trends. So we looked at the trends and we were able to project what the payroll was based on past trends. There was no other issues that county, Ceres, or the courts talked about that made me want to alter the trend that I was seeing in payroll last year. This year we calculated trend, talked to the county, Ceres, and the courts. And there were some issues that came up that forced us to rethink what our projected payroll was.
You're talking about contributions from payroll.
Yes, but all we do is we want to project the payroll, because then we just take the actuary's projections and multiply the projections by the payroll. So if payroll goes down but actuarial projections remain the same, then our contributions go down as well. So there's two effects here in terms of the contributions.
Well, I think the vacancy rate.
Let me just say that there are mitigating circumstances to the payroll that I'm not at liberty to discuss right now. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Excuse me?
There are mitigating issues to projected payroll that I'm not at liberty to discuss right now. I've been asked to keep that confidential.
Is that discussed in open session? Or
is what discussed in open session?
With the mitigating...
That was discussed with me in private.
But can you discuss it in closed session?
I cannot.
We're negotiating a lot of
MOUs. Yeah.
Right. I can't do it.
I just wondered if the closed session would make a difference.
So, you guys, there's out of the 4,000 of the county, there's probably 3,000 employees that are impacted by negotiations that are being negotiated right now.
Absolutely.
And we don't know the results of that.
Correct. That's a better way than what I just did. Thank you, Mark.
You're right, it is a better way.
And then the other part is the actuarial projections. So last year we took the actuary's projections for the next 6 years, what the contribution rates were projected to be for the next 6 years, and then we projected our contributions based on that. And then we looked at it this year, and the actuarial projected rates for the next 6 years are actually decreasing by 4% because we had a very good investment return the year prior. And so what that means was, since we had a good investment year the year prior, the actuary readjusts his projected rates downward, and so our contributions are expected to be somewhat lower than they were when we did the projection last year. So you combine the fact that the actuary's projected rates are decreasing over the next 6 years, and with different changes in payroll assumptions, that's what's causing the large required increase in this strategy to fund this process over the next. And if you think about it, it's kind of good, though, Because what is happening here is that when the markets are doing well, the actuary's projected contribution rates decrease. And then this process forces us to take more money to fund these shortfalls. So when the markets do well, we're taking more of the money from the good returns and investing it in assets that are less risky. If this were to change and we have a bad year, then the actuary is going to come along and say, oh, I've got to raise contribution rates for the next 6 years. And so our shortfalls would actually go down because we're getting more money. So we would take money out of the risky assets and maybe put them into something a little more risky. So the movement in terms of the market changes and the actuarial projections and this process work in the right direction.
I have a question, Rick.
Sure.
If last June, you know, 11 months ago, we approved the Insight contract for $100 million mm-hmm. for the 7-year shortfall coverage, and less than a year later, you're saying to make that goal, we have to add $142 million more.
Because our contributions are not going to be as high as we thought they would over the next 6 years when we did this last year. Because we had good returns and actuarial projected contribution rates are going down by 4% each year for the next 6 years. They're going down. So our contributions are going to be less. So if our contributions are going to be less, remember this. If our contributions are going to be less, that means our shortfall is more. You can see by this equation. So our contributions are going to drop because our actuarial contribution rates for the employers are going down. They're going to be giving this system less money.
So how much is our retirement payroll going to increase?
The retirement payroll is still increasing at about the same rate it always is. That's a pretty easy projection to make. I think it increases about 4 or 5% each year. I can't remember exactly
The only way I can see our contributions going down as a result of payroll is an incentivized program to get folks to retire, and that puts more people into the PEPR plan, and it puts people in at first tier payroll, which is going to make those two things together are going to bring down your contributions over a 6-year period.
That and the fact that if we get good investment returns, it's going to bring down contributions, and that's what's happening here. I hear what you're saying. That's a long-term systemic issue with the pension plan.
Isn't that going to be a while before we realize that?
Pardon me?
Isn't that going to be a while before
we realize
that?
It'll be slow.
Yeah.
But Rick, I had a question. I think we've already discussed, you know, why we need it for 7 years. But can you repeat why 7 years? You know, why?
So, yeah, that's a good question. So, originally last year, let me get to this page here. Last year, we had originally said it was going to be 6 years. And when we calculated the shortfall liability after you folks agreed to do a 6-year plan, we had enough assets in that $100 million to actually do 7 years. So, I came to you a month later and I said, hey, we want to do 7 years. You guys said, okay, do it. So, that's why we ended up doing 7 years. So we can keep it at 7 years, or we can, if you decide you don't want to do 7 years, we can adjust that downward. And this would be the resulting additional assets that would be needed to fund 6543. You have to realize, though, on the surface, in terms of return generation, if we go back to talking about total return, it's probably not going to matter a whole lot whether you do 7 or 6, because we're just going to shift this money between our two fixed income managers and the duration of their portfolios, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, it's pretty close to the same, and the returns that they're generating are pretty close to the same as well. So from a total return perspective, I doubt whether you choose 6 or 7 is going to matter a whole lot.
Yeah, think about this. If we were to fund the 7 years, Insight would get $219 million. That's about 10% of the overall portfolio, right? A little over 10%. We're going to be looking at a proposed asset allocation later, which actually has a 20% allocation to short-term fixed income. So we are looking at having much, you know, a much higher amount in total of the asset class. It really is, as you say, a question: how much goes to Insight versus how much goes to Dimensional. Insight is the one doing the matching for us, and that's why that number is key. That's important. But in terms of overall asset allocation, I don't really see any material difference.
So theoretically, this maintains that the system's ability to pay our benefits for the next 7 years, given the current assumptions that we are expecting to materialize. Now, next year when I come back to you again, it could very well be that we say we want to, if we have a bad year in fiscal year 18-19, it could be very well be and most likely be that I'm going to ask you guys to take money from this account and give it back to DFA because the employers are going to start kicking down more money because we had a bad year the year previous. It just so happens that this year we had such a good year in the year prior that the actuary, when he projects his rate, says, hey, we don't need that much money from you guys. You had a good year. We can lower contribution rates, and that's what's happening right here. Again, lower contribution rates means higher shortfalls from our perspective. We got to come up with more money from the asset portfolio to fund these shortfalls. Does that make sense?
Are you calculating, you know, the smoothing too? Say we had a good rate of return, or is it just...
Yes, the actuary. So when we use the actuarial rates, as we project line number four, as we project what our contributions are going to be, that the ability for us to do that comes directly from the actuary, and the actuary's projections obviously incorporate the smoothing that's taking place. Absolutely.
The smoothing is how many years? Six?
So we smooth assets. We recognize asset gains and losses over a five-year period. So we recognize one-fifth of the asset gains every year. So anyway, we would be looking to transfer approximately $143 million as close as we can around June 30th to maintain that 7 years of shortfall. And again, there's what we would need to do if we wanted to shorten that. And that's just a repeat of staff's recommendation. And that's all I have.
Rick, what perplexes me is how 11 months ago we do $100 million for this. And now we have to do $142 million more. It's a quarter of $1 billion in a year to pay for the seven-year shortfall.
It's actually more close to $118 million, really, to be honest with you, because we want to fund them at 219. We gave them $100 million last year. Again, I don't know how else to explain this other than the fact that 4% of a $300 million payroll each year is a lot lower contributions that are coming in.
But that means that the county and the employers are paying
less
people, less money.
Well, they're...
And that's counterintuitive.
No, they are benefiting from the investment returns we had the year prior. And the actuary is saying, you don't have to pay us that much money. You don't have to... Your contribution rate is going to go down because we had a good investment return. And because of that, our shortfalls, again, are higher. We're not getting that money in to fund our benefits. We got to get it from someplace else.
So is there like a delayed year cycle then? If the year before you're...
Yeah, you're always a year behind.
Yeah, you're earning well, so
yes.
you don't need the 4%. So
yes.
The contributions on the subsequent year are going to be less.
Yes.
So there's always this timing period
so
of the year.
You guys just approved the actual evaluation in February of this year that was based on the status of the plan on June 30th, 2017, but it doesn't get implemented until 18. Exactly.
So, Rick, your point is that the $118 million will earn about the same rate anyway?
Yes.
Same rate of return?
Yes.
So where is it now? The $118 would come from, like, cash?
No, it comes from our other investment manager, DFA. So we've got about how much of the portfolio across both managers?
18%.
18%. Mm-hmm. So we would just transfer it from DFA to Insight. And again, it's very possible that next year we'd be just transferring money back from Insight to DFA. The Insight is our, even though the returns are not that much different, their function is tremendously different.
Right.
Insight is setting up this portfolio to fund those shortfalls right when we need it. So they're investing in bonds that pay coupons and mature at just the right point in time.
Right.
So they are doing something definitely different than DFA is.
Yeah.
Well, Rick, is this an unusual miscalculation of what our shortfall is?
So I knew last year that this would have an effect, there would be an effect here. I didn't think it would be that much. I honestly didn't realize that Graham, I didn't realize the actual evaluation would lower the projected employer rates by 4% over that long period of time. I figured even in good years we'd have a 1 or 2% decrease, and in bad years 1 or 2% increase in contribution rates. I didn't expect it to fall that much. But regardless, that's really not that big a deal, again, because, again, we're just shifting between two fixed income managers here that are essentially giving us the same total return anyway.
What would you estimate the rate of return is at $140 million, 2 or 3%?
Expected rate of return? So, yeah, if a duration, the duration on the portfolio is about 2.9. So what would that give us, Ed, do you think?
Yeah, so we think of it as, and we model it as a 2% kind of return. And with Insight, because they're holding bonds to maturity, that's pretty much exactly what we're getting. When we take a look at the performance book, the bonds are marked to market, and so they'll show pluses and minuses on any individual quarter. But we really don't care about that because we're holding them to maturity. So whatever they're currently valued at is fine. When they come due, as long as they don't default, they pay off at par. So we get 100, and that's the 3% that we're getting. In fact, I think your slide earlier that kind of showed the net increase. Yes, that one.
Yes.
So showing total net return line there, we have it on the assets of -0.29% in a rising rate environment against the liabilities. Total net return of -0.33% is that they match the liability quite well, which is exactly what we hired them to do. And in fact, they outperformed by 4 basis points.
Right.
So even better.
They've actually improved the funded status of those liabilities on a relative basis. So the program is really working. It's doing what it's designed to do in all aspects of the program. It's just that, you know, some of the assumptions, I don't know if we truly realize that actuarial projected rates were going to change that dramatically. But again, a 4% change in contribution rates on a $300 million payroll is a lot of money. It's a tremendous amount of money. So you're looking at what, $12 million, 4%? That's $12 million annually less contributions that we're going to be getting from our plan sponsors. Anyway, that's all I have.
And that could change, like, I mean, that's good for now. That could flip, you know,
next year. Easily.
Next year.
I hope that you're not taking this as a negative. This is actually a positive. This is a good thing that we are seeing happening. The employer rates are going down. We're taking some of those good returns that we earned and we're putting it, well, I mean, it's already in fairly safe assets, but we're putting it in assets that are matching our liabilities very, very closely. That's a good thing.
So, Rick, do you guys have a projection for what the number will be this time next year?
No, I won't know until Graham. I know now that the biggest factor in determining the change is Graham's projections. So it's going to depend on, so actually right now, based on where the markets are right now, we're very close to our discount rate. So this won't change hardly at all next year. If we hit our actual bogey and we're pretty close to that, we may just come back and ask you for that second line, the increase due to the new seventh year, and there'll be very small losses on the rest of the portfolio. If we end up doing very, very well this year, let's say we end up earning 12, 13, 14% again, that number is going to increase again because the actuary is going to come back next year and he's going to say, I'm going to lower the employer contributions.
Again.
They're going to be giving us less money. And so if you want to maintain the 7 years of benefit insurance, you got to dedicate more money to this process. Again, that's a good thing. That ain't a bad thing.
Members? Any comments or questions? Is there a motion?
So with respect to item 6A, I'll move the staff recommendation, which on the agenda is maintain a 7 year shortfall immunization process, and number two, transfer approximately $143 million from DFA to Insight on or around June 30th, 2018, with the actual transfer value to be based on a final valuation in mid-June.
Is there a second?
A second. Second.
Okay, and then is there a discussion? Any comments or questions from the board members?
I just have one small concern. So plus or minus, if we get some really large swing in the market, which can happen,
Is there
a collar here?
Well, I had originally had plus or minus $10 million, but I just took it out because I have a hunch that unless interest rates aren't going to dramatically increase or decrease over the next month and a half. So I think the bigger risk is one of the plan sponsors coming back and saying things are going to be different in terms of payroll. So I don't know what the sensitivity to that question is, but I can come back to you if it's going to be, you know, if you want to go plus or minus 10%, we can do that. Again, I thought about doing something like that, but I kind of nixed it because I don't know if it's going to change a whole lot.
I would just hate to be surprised.
I'll tell you what, if you can trust my judgment, if it's really out of whack, then I'll bring it back to you in June.
Okay.
And if it's close, I mean, it's not going to be exactly that. There's no way.
I'm not looking for it
okay.
to be that. I'm looking for it to not be 40%.
Oh, no. Okay.
I'm looking for it to not be, you know, 10% seems reasonable, but
if it's something that feels not right to me, I'll bring it back to you folks.
Like, wow. Yeah. I just don't want to be in a wow position. That's my only concern.
So it's moved. Are you? Sorry.
The five-year smoothing that we have, doesn't that kind of minimizes an investment gain or investment loss that's kind of out of whack? That's the whole reason it's smoothing.
It does. What it would do is it would create stability in those projected contribution rates for 6 years. So that's why the projected contribution rates last year for 6 years were here, and they all dropped. They all dropped because of smoothing. So they all kind of dropped about the same amount. And that explains the large increase in that portion of this plan.
But without the smoothing, the drop, the fluctuations would be much more.
They would. Then you'd see it go down, and then you'd see projected contributions go up again, and that would actually kind of thwart this whole process, make it very difficult to administer from year to year. So again, this is really a good outcome that we had this year. So.
Well, it's been moved and seconded to support to pass the staff recommendation. Please call the roll.
Lauren Klein.
Aye.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, next item. Raven.
Item 6B.
What about
Mandy? I'm
sorry. She doesn't have a Mandy?
Yes.
Sorry. She didn't put your name.
I think I got cut off.
Yeah. My bad. Sorry.
All right. Item 6B, Raven Capital Annual Meeting, and Chris Wisdom.
Can we turn the light on?
Oh, sure.
I'll get it.
We can. We're going to turn it off in a minute here anyway. But okay. This is an information-only item, just to let you know that Rick and I went to Raven's Annual General Meeting earlier this month in New York. It was an opportunity to meet essentially everyone that works at Raven. It was very well attended by their employees. They gave us an organizational update. Talked about their existing funds and then the fund they're currently raising for, which is the Opportunity Fund 4. As you recall, Stan Serra is invested in two of the Raven funds, number one and number three, and it was a good meeting. I think it was informative, but we are not recommending any changes at this point, so there's no action there. Any questions?
Okay.
All right.
6C.
So the next item, as Mike said, item 6C, this is an information-only item. Also, I want to remind you that that doesn't preclude you from taking action. We have that ability in any of our agenda items. And this is a discussion about private markets RFI process update. Before I hand this over to Chris, I just want to let you know that, as you know, we put out an RFI for private asset consulting services. And Chris and I have been reading these over the last couple weeks, and the picture that is starting to become very clear to us is the processes that are available to us in terms of implementing this private market portfolio. I'm learning a lot of stuff. I think you've learned some stuff as well. And so we are seeing some things that we are going to be going through that ultimately you are going to be asked to do: investment types, governance structures, discretionary levels in terms of investments. We are seeing these as being issues that we're going to have to deal with, confront, and make decisions on. And so we want to get this out to you today before staff comes back with a final recommendation on how to implement this program. We want to get this out to you today. We want to hear what your thoughts are, because your thoughts obviously are going to matter to us in terms of the recommendation that we come back and make next month. So this should be a very wide open discussion. Any concerns that you might have about governance issues, about discretion, about investment types, this is the time to really bring this up and discuss it right now. So Chris, it's all yours.
Yeah, that's a great intro. Anything you can do to help us narrow the field or point us in the right direction, that's why you're here. So today we'll talk a little bit about the space, private markets, private equity, private credit, just as a refresher. I'm going to talk about this RFI process that we've been going through and where we're at. We'll cover some of those issues and decisions that we will need to think about at some point. And we'll talk about what some other systems have done in California in particular. So why did we do this? We did this for asset allocation reasons. The board approved an allocation to private equity and private debt. And for all the usual reasons, we expect a higher return, added diversification, and these are some of the investments that we're talking about here on the page. These are the things that Stansera will likely be investing in. So some of these might be familiar to you, and maybe some aren't, and that's okay. It's very different than anything that we have done in the past. So we just want to go in eyes wide open. This is an illiquid asset class. We want to take advantage of that illiquidity premium. But it requires additional expertise that we may not have. That's why we got talking about this in the first place.
Does anybody have any comments on these types of investments? Anybody?
They sure look like risky investments for a retirement board.
Okay.
I mean, way out of character from what I think they should be investing in.
Anyone else? I know some of the, you know, the word leverage, sometimes that's that raises eyebrows. I want to get it out there. I don't want to have surprises later, so I want to put together a program appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, before we really spend a lot of time in this program, we need to make sure that you guys feel comfortable making these types of investments, because it's going to be a little bit more difficult, not impossible, to turn off the spigot once we get going on this thing, because a lot of the expected return probably, Ed, comes from investments of this type, right? And as we start to winnow this this opportunity set down, then the expectations on the returns that we'll get from this portfolio will start to change.
So
I could share some of Jim's concerns about not knowing what we're getting into.
Okay.
And distressed debt tells me that this debt that really is, whatever the project is it's really in trouble. So how do we profit off that? I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely considered to be a high risk, high return asset class.
You know, back a while ago, we thought as the retirement board increased its assets, became closer to fully funded, that we would go into safer investments to minimize the risk. Mm-hmm. And as our funding ratio has been increasing and gradually, we're going just the opposite way. It is really high risk, investments that we really shouldn't be in. I don't understand any of this. I've invested over my life since I was a teenager, and I wouldn't put any money in mine or anything like that.
Yeah.
Especially the retirement system, going into the really high risk types of investments that we don't really understand fully.
So what are you asking us for, Rick?
Nothing right now.
Nothing. We just want, this is exactly what we want, is to hear your comments.
This is important feedback for us.
This is what we're looking for.
I'm just not comfortable with this because I don't understand it.
Okay.
It looks, without knowing a whole lot about it, but it just looks like it's just overly risky.
Okay.
Is there something staff could do to bring more comfort to these types of investments?
I don't know if we really need these types of investments. We've always done pretty well on the equity markets, and I just kind of wonder if we're not going in the wrong direction. I mean, we got later on in the agenda where we're going to get out of some of our equities and go into emerging
market debt,
mm-hmm. Third world countries that probably won't even pay us back. I'm just really not comfortable with the direction we're going.
I agree at the asset allocation level is where we need to have this type of discussion and have everyone's input. As staff, I have to work with the allocation we've got currently, and that's what we're doing here.
I understand that. Yeah. I mean, it's giving you my opinion.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit probably worse.
No, it's important, of course.
I just think we ought to be in more reasonable investments that we understand.
So, Chris, could we talk about some of the things on here? There is definitely some gradation up there. So if we're talking about senior debt.
Yep.
Okay, even private placement of senior debt, we know that it's going to have first call on the assets.
That's right.
Of the company. So of that whole group, I look at that and I think, okay, senior debt.
I'm good there, right?
Yeah. I have no problem there.
Yeah.
Mezzanine financing,
mm-hmm.
I'm generally okay there.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to agree, distressed buyouts.
Yep.
that's going to keep you awake. LBOs, distressed debt,
mm-hmm.
those are kind of at the opposite end of that spectrum. And I just think there's some opportunities to pick and choose out of that list that would give more comfort instead of seeing them up there as a grid,
yep.
You know, more of a continuum of risky, less risky might be helpful.
Okay.
Because
special situation, please.
That's kind of my catch-all for anything else. You could put in, we've done some special situations in the past with some of our direct lending managers, frankly. Right?
I think you could gradate that and really give a better feel for what, I mean, venture capital.
Yep.
That can go a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
It could be first time
yeah.
venture capital. It could be a third funding of
yeah.
venture capital.
There's a lot of,
yeah.
You're right. So. Absolutely right. I hear you. So what I'm hearing is, number one, maybe a need for some more education. Number two, maybe looking for a level of customization here, picking and choosing,
yes.
right?
Yes.
That is possible.
I think that's helpful.
Okay. And I think I agree that in isolation, maybe any one of these, especially if you think about it, any one deal, oh my gosh, buying Toys R Us in the situation it's in, that's very, very risky. But we do need to recall that this would be part of a larger portfolio, right? So. Context, but I hear you and I understand.
So what's our goal? What's our total target acquisition and the percentage of the total portfolio for this?
We currently have an 11% allocation. Later on, we're going to see recommended allocation says 10%, 5 to equity, 5 to credit. Okay, so 10% of 2.1 billion is 210 million.
And this is designed to enhance what part of the portfolio?
Well, it's the liquid part of the portfolio. It's the growth part of the portfolio.
Right.
Since we've got, illiquid.
Yeah,
it's illiquid. The growth part of the portfolio. So since we've got this works in tandem with the functionally focused portfolio presentation. Since we've got our our liability is covered for 7 years, we can withstand some volatility in this part of the portfolio.
So this was meant to shock a little bit, and that's okay.
It is.
Let's keep going. Well, one more comment?
Well, I was going to say, if I can be allowed to be a little provocative here, we have to be careful in terms of our ability to pick investments that we know enough to where we can, you know, pick investments better than the experts out there. I mean, if you're looking at staying out of investments to avoid tail risk, large shocks to the portfolio, I think I can understand that. But if you're staying out of investments because you think that they won't return, you know, what the professionals think, then I would be cautious there.
Okay.
I just think that in a lot of ways, thinking about the appetite, the risk appetite of this board,
yep,
overall, I mean, we have some higher risk, some lower risk. But when we start looking at it overall, I think there's a lot of headline aversion. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that we have to be really cognizant of.
Yeah, and be able to stomach, absolutely. If I can ask Ed and Chris, in a typical implementation process, does the board understand, know, and see the return on every investment that's incorporated into that program? I mean, will this board be looking at every single investment and knowing which ones are not doing well and which ones are doing well, or will it be focused more on just a higher level look at this program?
I would envision the higher level.
Transparency is always available.
Yeah.
So we can if we choose.
There would be no intent to hide any of that. Okay. And if a manager wanted to hide any of that, that would cause real issues. So they wouldn't introduce. In terms of regular reporting, what you would see is either a line item per fund, like what you see today with Raven, Medley, White Oak, that kind of thing, or a roll-up if you were to choose to go with a model where you said, we're going to hire firm XYZ to provide us with our private debt portfolio. They would probably just roll that up. And you see that on a quarterly basis, and when you want to better understand how the performance is doing, that would be additional reporting when it needed to cut it.
So how much of this has got interest rate risk attached to it? I would say probably quite a bit.
Yes,
I would think so.
Anytime, you know, anytime,
so given the fact that the markets have baked in about 3.5 on the 10-year going out to towards the end of the year, if we get north of 3.5, if we've already bought ourselves into this, and interest rates continue to rise beyond 3.5, I would rather see us. I mean, I don't know. I just see the potential now getting into something like this, given the fact your prior comments that if interest rates do start to rise, that we're more in a position to capitalize on that rising interest rate environment, or are we already in a position to capitalize on that?
It's a difficult question to answer because the timing of making the commitment versus
being
employed.
Yeah.
And managers that you hire are entitled to make that decision as well in terms of what deals they're seeing. Are there attractive deals worthy of investing? And, you know, we see managers go for extended periods of time saying, no, you know what, we don't see anything that meets our investment criteria, so we are going to pass, we are going to pass, we are going to pass, waiting for that right opportunity for what meets the criteria and then jump on that hard. So it's really hard to say. What we have found is timing a private markets commitment is really hard to do, so you tend to develop a private markets program, and you weather the storms when those issues happen, and you benefit when they're tailwinds to your performance, and that works out okay.
Yeah, because I think that there are probably other Toys R Us situations waiting to happen out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt. The interesting dynamic across all of these is that when you're hiring anyone to do it, like take venture capital, I think that's probably something a lot of Northern Californians are familiar with. familiar with, because they tend to get a lot of headlines when things go well, and there are a lot of success stories around here doing that. But those venture capitalists tend to experience a 1 in 10 success, 9 failures or more. And when they hit that 1 success, it is a home run. It generates enough profits to cover all of their losses and then some. And so, you know, we tend not to focus on the losses, and we tend to enjoy the upside, and it works well as a portfolio. The venture capitalists, of course, continue to learn from their lessons, and they're active not just in terms of like what we think of like a Dodge and Cox or LSV buying and selling the stocks. They're actually taking positions on the boards, putting their network of people in place, their operators, helping them expand the distribution, helping combine companies. So it's a really activist kind of role, as opposed to just active investing. They're actually changing the way these companies work and behave. That's true for every one of these situations, whether it be on the debt side or the equity side. You know, buyouts, leveraged buyout has, I think, a bad connotation from Wall Street the movie and from KKR and Nabisco days, got a lot of headlines back then. But actually, it's a very smart, functioning way of taking over a company and redesigning it financially. So the active managers really have the same alignment of that you do. It is a riskier part of what is available on the investment spectrum, and that's why we ring fence it with a smaller allocation and balance it out with a liquidity program, knowing that, yes, it is riskier, but the returns are there. And so it's
how much of this do we have control over as far as what was mentioned, a highly customized portfolio? Or are we basically at the risk of whatever manager we hire, and they tell us where that money is going to be invested?
So we're going to get into that. Yeah. That's one of the things we're definitely going to address here.
Yeah.
We want to hear your thoughts there on that as well.
Because I see this as it has a lot of similarities to direct lending.
Okay.
I think as interest rates, if interest rates continue to rise, there are opportunities in these spaces, mm-hmm, because these types of institutions are not going to be able to go borrow, and so they're going to be looking for other ways to get capital, and the risk is going to be high, but the potential rewards for us are going to be even higher. But then I think it goes back to how much control are we going to have on customizing our own portfolio, keeping the risk at a comfortable level, and then getting some returns out of it long term. Because and I'm talking fast here because I got to go in a few minutes. What's the timeline for tying up? What's the illiquidity timeline on something like
multi-year?
Multi-year. 7 to 10 years.
I'm thinking 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So and honestly, we got to be willing to buy in.
We're in bed with these folks. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
When you talk about timeline, you should back to what Ed said about the venture capitals. So you've got losses, 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 huge gain, losses, losses, losses. And that's something that, you know, we aren't always really great at accepting the losses, 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 losses in preparation of the huge gain. And then back to losses, losses, losses.
Right. Well, the other part, and I learned this talking with KKR at the recent Sackers conference with respect to Toys R Us, they waited too long to exercise influence over the direction that company was taking. And Toys R Us waited too long to try to get back, you know, to move into spaces that were being taken over and occupied by Amazon and others. They just waited too long. So that's the other part. Not only do we customize it, but then how much control do we have over the limited partnerships or whatever structure we have gotten ourselves into, and how much control do those LLPs have over the function of those companies? Because, right, you know, Jim has pointed out in the past, you know, we hold on to these things, and we could ride them all the way down to the bottom, and then they're asking us for more capital calls.
And we're committed.
And we're committed, and they're just bleeding us dry. So that would be my other thing, is not only the customization component, but how much control do we have over these partnerships. So I need to get going, and I apologize. And I apologize for my dress down today, Jim. I didn't wear a suit, so I apologize.
We're going to hold that against you. against you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Darren.
I mean, my problem with this is just kind of philosophical. What is a proper investment for a retirement
okay.
board? They now remind everybody of that hedge fund that we got into. It was supposed to be this great deal. Mm-hmm. And we put in, I don't know, $20 million or so. We lost $10 million of that in just about 6 months' time.
Yeah.
Which I told you, you shouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. And I did it anyway. So that's $10 million thrown away on an investment we should have never gotten into. And I just think that a retirement board should not be in these really highly risky investments where, you've got something, loss, and a big gain, and more losses, and I just think it's improper for us to invest in these sorts of things with other people's money.
Right. Well, the idea is, and the data show, that if you aggregate many types of those types of investments, that over time they will provide a healthy expected return. So that's the theory. It's not just one deal. I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit. Your point is taken, though.
I mean, we've already got these other alternative investments with Lightpost and Haven. And honestly, I can't tell you whether we're making any money or not on these things. I don't understand their return. I mean, it's just, I don't know if it's a good investment or not. We've been in it for a few years, and you're in for the long term on a lot
you
of this
are.
Stuff. I mean, it's all right to have long-term investments in a retirement system. When you're in a long-term investment and an investment that you don't really understand fully or have no control over, I'm just not sure if that's the right place we want to be.
Okay.
I think first, I think the minute should show that Trustee Garrett left at 2:37.
He did.
All right.
Okay.
So my concern isn't so much some of the boxes are scary.
Yep.
Okay. Right? But my concern is if we do 10% in private markets into one of those eight boxes,
mm-hmm.
we create a situation 6 months from now where Rick and Ed and everyone is saying to keep to our balance, the best possible thing in private markets happens to be distressed debt in their Nicaragua. I don't want to be placed in that kind of a locked position.
Okay.
So
I'll talk about some ways we can manage that, but I understand the concern.
Okay.
Okay. I think any route we go definitely contemplates being diversified to try to manage that. So I will move on. So if this is the what we might be investing in, this is a little bit of the how or some of the things we might need to think about. And we would need to determine these things. How to get access. I mentioned primaries versus secondaries versus co-investments. We don't need to necessarily get into those details right now, but maybe the ones below are a bit more easier to think about. Geographic focus. Do we want this to be purely in the United States or North America, or would we like a global approach here? How much, what percent could potentially go in Europe or Asia?
So, Chris, these are the things that we would ask the board before we ventured into this asset class. Set parameters relative to these key factors.
I think the board would absolutely have to give input here and decide how tight we want to set guide rails with whoever we want to work with here. Okay, sectors is very important. There are a lot of sector funds out there. Okay, this is the J curve, famous for negative cash flows in the first years and then hopefully positive cash flows in the later years. The point here is that this is really a very long-term commitment. And we talk about a fund perhaps existing 7 years, give or take. But what we want to do, if we're to do this successfully, is leg into this year by year by year by year. And we might not know until past 7 years. It could be 10 years before you can really judge this on an investment return performance metric. Again, this is just a reminder that this is very different than our decision to hire a manager in the public markets like a Dodge and Cox that we have, that you can turn around and you can fire a typical public markets manager. This is a commitment. Okay, so it's the same way we've been operating with our private funds, and I think we need assistance in terms of how to pace this, looking at it year by year. Okay, so what does it take? These are the things that need to be done. And these are some broad categories, but whether we were to do this ourselves, with our consultant, with a different consultant, whatever the case may be, somebody has to source these deals, do the appropriate due diligence on them, both the strategy, the operation. I mean, there's background checks. This is very, very involved. Legal negotiation, of course, putting that all together in a portfolio, and then the ongoing monitoring and reporting. So one way or another, even if you buy a fund of funds, that all this is kind of done for you in one fell swoop in that case. Or if we do something a bit more custom, we have to figure out where we're going to, how we're going to approach these different areas. Okay. And I do want to step back, because if you recall, what was it, 2 months ago, we had Ed come in and talk about what Varis can do for us. We called it Varis Light affectionately, because it does differ in terms of Varis's full suite of service, in terms of the access to the private market specialist that would work on it. But just as a reminder, Varis presented their services. They can absolutely do this for us and do a credible job in terms of bringing a portfolio to us. Second bullet point, this is key. This would be a non-discretionary arrangement. What do we mean by that? Varis wouldn't have discretion to pull the trigger and invest the money. The board would, right? So that's normal. That's the way we have always operated. Okay? That's what non-discretionary is. And Ed would deliver those services. And we would have that arrangement for an additional flat fee. This would still be based, the investment due diligence would all be done by Varis' private markets team, the experts in San Francisco. Ed, anything else I'm missing on this, really? Not to spend a whole lot of time on it. Okay. And so the board heard this, and then the board said, okay, that sounds great, but let's just see what else is out there in the marketplace, right? So that's why we did the RFI. Just, we heard about one model, we wanted to see what else was out there as a potential solution. So the board approved posting an RFI. We did that in April, and the deadline for responses was May 11th, and we received 26 formal responses for private markets design and implementation services. So that was great. We have not had time to review these fully. The deadline was a Friday afternoon, May 11th. The following week was Sackers. Honestly, we've been through some of them. Maybe a good percentage, but we haven't read them all between Rick and I. So we're in the process of analyzing this. I have some information to share, maybe not much, or maybe not much that would be statistically valid. But I can tell you a little bit about what we're seeing, and again, looking for your guidance in terms of what you like, what you don't like, and some of the things that I'm going to tell you here. So these are the names of the folks that responded. Wow. Okay. 26. You'll recognize a number of names here, and some you probably won't. You'll note that there's a handful here that are typically thought of as kind of being general consultants. Like Averis, these are the folks you see that are Sackers or other systems work with in terms of their general consultant. And we've got a lot of private market specialists here, and all they do is, you know, build customized programs for plans like us. Okay, so I think it was a healthy level of response. I'm pleased that this many groups want to are eager to work with us. Okay. Oops. And here's, I guess, some of the observations I've already mentioned. I would say many, not all, but many have experience doing this type of work in California for public plans. Okay. So now, stepping back, we talked about the market, who wants to work with us. Let's talk about some of these models. You can kind of broadly group things into four models that they're listed here on the left. How do you implement something this complex? Staff-led, consultant-led, advisory, and fund of funds. Let me talk about staff-led. This is something I don't see as practical for Stansera, but this would be applicable for a very large pension plan or endowment that has multiple staff members who are experts in the space with the contacts and experience to build their own program without even needing a consultant. We're nowhere near that, okay? So I mentioned it here for completeness. That's really just not practical for us. I'm making a distinction here from what I'm going to call consultant and advisory in the middle. I'm calling them preferred. And the way I want you to think about those is consultant, think about how we currently work with a consultant. And think of that non-discretionary type of model, so where where a consultant would bring ideas to the board would vote yay or nay, and move forward, and the program gets built little by little. Advisory, again, I'm making a distinction here. I'm going to call this a firm that might have more discretion to, you know, maybe an investment manager that puts together the program for us with some level of our involvement that we decide what would be appropriate. Could be something as simple as, you know, hey, fully discretionary, but we want veto power for any particular deal. Or could be we have to approve deals over a certain dollar number or something like that. But essentially an advisor with direct relationships that can kind of speak for the money and not have to come to the board for approval. Okay. Finally, at the bottom, I mentioned fund-of-funds here. Fund-of-funds typically had kind of a bad rap, but that's the easy solution. That would get us our private equity exposure in one fell swoop, and all of those things that need to be handled, like sourcing and legal negotiation, it's just all done. That's the easy button. They've been knocked before for maybe being over-diversified and maybe not getting as high returns as what you can build by yourself, and historically been thought of as expensive, although I don't know that that's necessarily the case today.
Well, Chris, why wouldn't we just do a couple of the fund of funds?
We could.
And not have to worry about the consultant or anything else.
That would be so easy. That would be great.
What's the downside?
Well, the fees.
The fees might be high, although, well, Ed, what would you say? I'm curious, compare and contrast. No. Well, yeah, you work with clients that do fund of funds,
yes.
And you do consult. So you've seen both sides,
yes.
Closer than I have.
Yeah. So the fund of funds are plug and play and easy to do. The drawbacks are you tend to get very broad exposure, so you really lose customization in terms of saying we prefer this more than that, or the market says this more than that. They tend to be pressured to put a lot of money to work. And so that also kind of ends up just giving you generic exposure. So in our jargon, we talked about that as being beta exposure. Yes, you're getting public markets or private markets exposure. It just lacks any kind of customization for what we see in the market as being beneficial. The layer of fees is the real challenge here, because you're at a scale now with a $2 billion plan, 10% allocation, $200 million. Total and building that program and maintaining it over time, but that level of fees is pretty significant. You can disintermediate that and save yourself quite a bit.
How about transparency issues?
So transparency in a fund of funds is that you're going to see what the underlying funds are. You're not going to see what those funds' holdings are. So you have, you know, full transparency into what they have invested your money in, but it's going to be something like what you're seeing today, that you invested in Medley and White Oak Raven. You're not going to see the holdings underneath Medley, White Oak Raven.
Yeah.
So there's less of a control too, right, from a decision making?
Yeah. Correct. I think that's what he's saying, with the more discretion.
Yeah, you're
discretion.
Giving
so you're
more discretion.
Over discretion to them to make those decisions,
yeah.
For you. You're retaining less of it.
Now, I'll mention one thing that's kind of becoming popular over the last couple of years is this idea of fund of one. This is a term you'll hear thrown around. So what's that? It is essentially a fund of funds, but it's designed just for you. For example, it would be designed just for Stan Sarah, and nobody else can invest in it. And so why do we do that? Well, that allows the customization, right? If it's just yours, you have some say in what you can and can't do. You can set those guidelines on the geography, on the sectors, on the, you know, I don't like distressed debt, but I, you know, I like leveraged buyouts or whatever the case may be. Because it's a separate solution for you. It's negotiable in terms of the fees. It may end up being cheaper than a fund of funds. Although you are creating a fund, there's some startup costs that go along with that. I'm still learning about this. I need to learn more, but I'm seeing this as a solution where some people say, you know, I like the easiness of the fund of funds, but I want to have the say and participate a little bit at least. So I want to create my own fund. It's a broad spectrum, and there's a lot of gray areas too, and solutions that could involve some aspects of both. But so maybe you ask the question, why not do it? And absolutely, it's on the table. It is a very reasonable solution. I will say my research has indicated that the private equity fund of funds marketplace seems to be deep enough for us to pull from. I don't know that there's much in the way of private credit. Do you know, Ed?
That's a good
There is not, is there?
There are predicates.
There are, but is it less deep? Is that fair to say?
Probably.
Okay.
I have never compared to that.
Right. My concern would be we might not be able to do it on the credit side, and we might need to. We might want to continue to do the one-off investments a la Raven, a la Medley, I don't know, and do a fund of funds on one side and direct investment on the other side. I don't know. Okay. So moving on. I mentioned, let's see here. Discretion here. Again, discretion is kind of the opposite of control. So if you want more control, that's less discretion. More discretion, that means you're giving more discretion. You're kind of giving up control. So what I wanted to talk about is your feelings on discretion. Right now, just so we recognize where we are accustomed to using discretionary managers. Our managers decide which stocks to buy, which stocks to sell. They're not telling us beforehand, right? Okay. And we use a non-discretionary consultant. That's Ed bringing us ideas. So I don't want people to think that discretion is something brand new. It's actually not. If you think about it, we do this with all of our managers.
And I think the point that should be made is they have a benchmark that we hold them to.
Yep.
And with this kind of investment, there's no benchmark or anything.
Yeah, it's more difficult, and you have to wait a longer time, and it's not as easy to monitor.
More difficult is an understatement.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, in terms of the spectrum of discretion, a fund of funds, you'd be giving up complete control. It's take it or leave it, one size fits all, right? And maybe that's okay for us. Maybe that's good enough to get that beta that Ed talks about, we get our exposure. If we want to have some control, some input, some negotiating power, we're maybe looking at this advisory model, or again, using a consultant like Averis or somebody else to bring us these ideas every deal, one by one. And that's the question for us, isn't it? How involved should we be? How much control should we retain? And if we're being honest with ourselves, do we have the right level of knowledge to add value to a program like this?
I don't know if we have the right level of knowledge, but we certainly have the right level of responsibility.
We do. So fiduciary responsibility, that's an important point. And I think there's two sides to that coin. Involvement traditionally has been a way to show that we're doing our fiduciary duty. The other way to look at it is, are we the experts? Or if not, should we be delegating this to the experts as we do in the equity markets? I mean, we're not here picking individual stocks. Maybe it's our responsibility to monitor some experts to do this for us. Okay? I don't know the answer. These are just the issues. Final question again. Do we really want to be approving every commitment? Maybe we do. I'll talk about what other systems do later, and that works for some systems. Okay? And then other systems don't want to do that, and they do outsource. Okay. I like this idea of education. Here's the thing. If you buy a fund of funds, we buy it. It's a line item. It's on our reports. We're not really learning that much as a board, as a staff. When you have a consultant bringing you these ideas, these deals, or an advisor, there is an opportunity to get educated, to get a little bit closer to it, to gain expertise and insight into the markets over time. I think it makes us a better investor. Maybe we need that. Maybe we don't. I did have us join ILPA, Institutional Limited Partnership Association. This is I think it's an important organization there. They're designed to educate and empower limited partners, kind of bring us together in terms of advocating for things like better terms, more standardized contracts, again, with general partners. And they seem to have really great educational resources and conferences.
So I think for me,
yep,
the level of discretion that I would want would be dependent on the type of investments we were talking about. So where I might be willing to give up some discretion to the fund manager for senior debt, mm-hmm, private placement senior debt, I might be less likely to do that on a venture capital deal,
okay,
where I would want to have more involvement, more understanding of exactly what you're talking about. I think it really just is very investment type specific.
Okay.
I agree with that.
If it's LBOs, I want to see the books.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what we're used to. We're used to being a pretty involved board. Okay. So just to dig in a little deeper, you know, that's what I refer to as the consultant model. If this would be non-discretionary and that, you know, who, the consultant we would work with would not make the decisions for us, I think it does allow for some customization. I had talked about this. If we were to work with Verus, for example, we could work with them to set some parameters for a program, but everything would be brought to the board for approval. Okay. When you work in this area, I think it's important to consider and try to evaluate if your consultant has access to some of the top performing general partners out there, right? There's a lot of evidence that says, you know, you really have to get access to the top quartile managers in the space to make this really worthwhile. Okay, so I think we have a sense of how that would work. You know, if we work with more of an advisor or more of a discretionary model, again, everything's kind of negotiable, but I mean, you could kind of create whatever works for you, but the idea would be to offload some of the day-to-day, month-to-month presentations right here, right? And we received a lot of proposals from folks that say, you know, we recommend discretionary. They think that's a better solution for us. And of course, we've seen other ones as well. This question of access is important. I mentioned on the other slide. Here's what we know. We know that there's a pretty wide disparity between top-performing funds and bottom-performing funds. So it pays if you can get access to some of these best managers. And, you know, I've been talking with a lot of people, and anecdotally, what I'm hearing is that the top managers in this space, they have their pick of who they want to work with, right? They're oversubscribed. They can choose. They've got the line around the block of people that want to get into them. Who are they going to choose to work with? They are going to choose the clients that are easy, you know, not the ones that need to wait 5 weeks to the next board meeting to take a decision. That's kind of the reality. They might prefer to work with an advisor who can speak for the money and say, yep, I got Stansera, they're in for $40 million, let go. That's easy for them. So it's very hard for me to quantify that or prove that to you, but you talk to a number of people in the space, you hear these sorts of stories. I think it's a little bit more pronounced these days with some of the fee disclosure requirements, this AB 2833. Some funds, some general partners just simply don't want to work with a California public plan for that reason. Like, why? It's just extra work. One way some people are able to comply with the law but still get access to those types of managers is by creating a fund. If they do a fund of one, for example, because you put those types of managers in a fund and all this fee information gets aggregated, sometimes they're willing to do that rather than just have it shown what their fees are exactly. I don't like that, but this seems to be something that I'm hearing out there. You know, we're all for transparency, of course, and complying with the law, and we're going to. But access is a difficult question. Any questions on that?
We see that most with venture capital.
Okay.
And venture capitalists, the successful venture capital firms, choose not to work
with California Publics?
Yeah, California Publics.
Yeah.
So, fine. Aside from that, not an issue across the rest of the
sector. So let's talk about some of the other folks are doing. I spoke with most systems, maybe not all. I don't think I caught up with the very, very largest ones. So here's my attempt to try to get to some of the trends or see what other folks are doing. There are three systems that don't have a PE program, Mendocino, Sonoma, and us. Mendocino is the smallest county in terms of assets. They've just never felt that they've been able to do this or never taken action to do it. Sonoma is actually larger than us in terms of assets, and they just have a belief that they think they're better served by not having a program. I think there's some doubt in terms of whether they can really get access to the top quartile managers, and therefore they choose not to participate. Then there's us. Okay, so everyone else has some type of program. And I was really hoping, I wish I could have created a chart or a graph and just bucket these and say, hey, you know, five are doing this, seven are doing this, and so on. But it's very complicated to do because these things developed over time. Oftentimes, you know, I mentioned here some of the smaller systems started out using fund-to-funds and now they're changing because they think they can do something better, maybe something a bit more bespoke. You know, sometimes some people might have a fund of funds and then do some other things on the side, or do one thing for private equity and something else for private credit. It's kind of all over the place, is what I'm seeing. I will say, this is an interesting point. I haven't come across an instance where a system uses a separate general consultant as their private markets consultant. So I'm saying a separate. It would be, it's not done that people hire two general consultants and give the alternatives to one of them and the rest of the portfolio to the other. People don't really do that. It is common, for example, the second bullet point here, Verisk does general and private markets consulting. So it's common to use the same consultant to do both, to do the whole portfolio. But not two general consultants to split it, two different ones. And everyone I spoke to seemed to be fairly happy. I mean, I tried probing them, you know, like, I guess if anything, it may be a little bit of a knock against the fund of funds, but just that they think they can do better, but not that they were really unsatisfied with any approach that they've taken. So everyone seems to be generally happy. I would say the happiest people seem to be the ones that have outsourced, if I had to make a broad statement.
Ignorance is bliss?
Yeah, maybe it could be. Could be. And it's worked, and, you know, it's easy for them, and they're getting great returns, and paying a reasonable fee, and, you know, I haven't spoken to enough people. It's not statistically significant. If I talk to two people that are happy doing that, that could be. Well, so anyway, you know, I was asked to try and get a sense of what other folks are doing. It's all over the place. Some people are using a specialty consultant that's separate. That seems to work fine for them. Some people use their general consultant. That seems to work fine for them. Some people outsource it, give someone full discretion. That seems to be great, too, in terms of their level of satisfaction. Costs, I don't have enough information to really talk about costs yet. We didn't ask for specific quotes in the RFI, because again, it's an RFI, not an RFP, and we're not able to narrow down our services yet. That's partly what this meeting is for. We know a typical consultant fee would probably be a flat dollar fee. Something by an advisor, investment manager with discretion would almost certainly involve a basis point fee, maybe even a carry. That is, they make even more money when they generate a higher return past a certain hurdle. That's good for alignment of incentives. You know, we like that, but that could be some serious dollars too, right? So either way, if we're going to this asset class, the services need to be paid for, right? So if we build a program manager by manager, we're probably still going to need to have our legal counsel review contracts. We have to pay for that. If we go to fund on funds, you know, we may be paying a higher fee, but we're, in a sense, buying their legal services wrapped in that fee. Everything needs to be paid for at some point. There's no hiding that. But there's too much information now and not enough specificity in what we're looking for me to narrow this down for you right now. So that's what I'm tending to cover here, and I know we've had a good discussion all the way through. We continue to have it, but you know, where should I go from here? Does the fund of funds solution have support, or should we continue to investigate working with some type of discretionary manager, or do we like the Verisk idea? You know, I don't know. Everything's on the table as far as I'm concerned.
So again, next month we plan on coming back with a recommendation. And that recommendation will be based on what we hear from you today and based on our continual review and reading of the RFIs that we have in place. So we will come to you next month with a recommendation.
I think first I would like to see sort of your take on the gradation of risk and volatility among the different types of investments you're proposing. So sort of, you know, a line from distressed debt to senior debt.
So can I read something into that comment and tell me if I'm right? So it sounds like that there are some investments. So it sounds like you would like a situation where you definitely have say or veto power over investments and or certain asset types based on?
Okay. I think that would be,
okay,
and I could be speaking just for myself, but I think I'm speaking for the whole board, where I'm hearing generally there are certain types of those investments that we would not have a stomach for.
But your concern is more at the asset strategy level, not necessarily the individual burrowing down on the individual.
Right.
Okay.
See, if it were more risky, I would be compelled to burrow down. And if it were of the less risky type, I might be able to see myself giving more discretion to someone and not feeling compelled to burrow down.
So there's a correlation between discretion and perceived levels of risk.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Can there be bands of risk, low, medium, and high?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
And do it that way and put those groups into low, medium, high risk bands?
I think that's, yeah.
And maybe we just need to start, can we start out slower, just focusing on just the low and medium?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unless
it seems to be where everybody's kind of going with this.
Do you have any comments on that, Ed? Okay, in terms of asset allocation and expected returns or anything like that, okay.
I understand it's possible to create, kind of a higher risk program versus a lower risk program. It sounds, what I'm hearing is we're probably more suited toward the lower risk program if we're to do this. Maybe potentially a lower risk fund of funds, we're just kind of known for that.
Possibly.
I spoke with one other system who said they like their manager a lot. They're known for, to use a sports analogy, kind of hitting singles and doubles, probably not the home runs, and they were very comfortable with that approach.
But maybe they don't have the experience of loss, 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 huge gain. Maybe it's loss, loss, medium gain.
Right.
Loss, loss, medium gain.
Right.
And maybe that would be more suitable for this system.
That could be, okay. I'm unsure at this point. I'll just tell you in terms of how I can compare risk, of venture capital to distressed debt, but I'll see what's out there. They'll do the work. I don't know that standard deviation is the right measure. I don't know. Well, I'll have to think about that. But I understand where you're coming from.
Well, what are your intentions for next month? Is it to pick one of these 26 people? Is that
no.
Not necessarily.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. If we felt strongly that one of those 26 people should be hired, we would probably make a recommendation for an RFP and narrow down the scope of what we're looking for and ask for a quote, and I think we're going to do further due diligence. It's always on the table right now and next month. It's part of our contract to authorize Varis to do this for us. That's always there.
I just wanted to see what your intentions were. Mm-hmm. And the amount of the investments is $200 million?
Approximately, probably going to grow a little bit above that, but yeah.
Okay, that's a lot of money to put in any risky investments we don't understand.
And I'm just on the question of transparency and discretion. I'm not, or I'm very hesitant to defer the choice to people I don't even know.
Okay.
Defer the choice of strategies or individual investments, like individual.
I think it depends on the
like Donna
the
said.
Risk parameter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. All right.
Okay.
Well, that's good. That's clear.
Mm-hmm.
So, question.
Yes.
In our policy today,
mm-hmm.
we have already decided that these are some of the strategies we're going to employ.
That's
right.
Correct, yeah.
And that's the 10% you're talking about?
Right. As of today, this moment, it's 11. It's 5% in equity, 6 in credit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So within that space is where you're going is, equity side and debt side.
Yep.
Private equity and private debt.
Yeah. And if those percentages need to be changed, we're having an asset allocation discussion in a few minutes,
right?
I have to work within the asset allocation I have.
And to meet the 7.25, our assumed rate of return, that's already baked into that assumption.
That's correct.
That's
partly how we get there.
Does it provide some sort of a defensive mechanism? When the equity market overall, there's bound to be a correction at some point, mm-hmm. I'm understanding, mm-hmm. as experts have been saying. You know, it's, some say it could happen this year. Some say, mm-hmm. look, it had more 3 to 5, I mean, 1 to 3 years more to run before that happens. So, you know, yeah. who knows? I mean,
I think there's definitely a dampening effect.
So how will that, if there's a correction, you know, what are the experts saying? How will this private equity and private debt counter against that?
I think they are related. They are correlated. I wouldn't know off the top of my head what those correlations are, but they're not perfectly correlated. So yeah. they wouldn't move exactly in tandem. You can imagine, let's say June 28th, right before actuarial valuation, assets fell 20%. That's going to have a pretty big impact on our valuation, on our quarterly report, everything, because we'll right. fall 20%. That might not work its way through the valuation process of some of these private investments. These things are lagged. There are other processes used to come up with values there. So there is a little bit of a defensive or dampening effect in that case, yes.
So given the expected return that we need to meet our actuarial discount rate, Ed goes back and he looks at capital market expectations, returns, risks, and he spits out a portfolio that's most optimal in terms of risk based on the return that we're seeking to get on the portfolio. And what comes along with that optimal risk is how correlated the assets are with one another. When one asset zigs, the other one zags, so to speak. So based on the return that we need to get this portfolio is probably the most optimal in terms of the risk-reward ratio.
And so
it means if you start to move out of these asset classes, then you have to kind of rethink your asset allocation in terms of optimal strategies and still being able to meet that assumed rate of return.
So you're saying if we're too safe and not risky enough, obviously we're not going to meet our rate of return.
That's right.
Unfortunately, that's the world we live in today. And I really mean that, unfortunately. And that's why I kind of tell some of the trustees, I mean, we'd love to see interest rates start to climb, because that's going to help us a lot in terms of being able to still earn what we want to earn and take risk off the table. But again, that's the world we live in today.
So we may not be able to satisfy this need if we go low, medium, and high and just choose the low band.
Right, we might do some medium.
Or you may, or some high. We don't know yet.
Well, we need to see. But at least but when you're making a decision, it's best to have all the data available.
No, I agree with that. I don't want, I wouldn't want us to say we're not going to look at high because it makes us a little unsettled.
No. Even today, probably every pension plan probably has one individual security in our plan somewhere that we would never buy if it was just that security, right? These things are always purchased in context of the broader portfolio. They had some kind of characteristic, are lowly correlated to something else, maybe with a high expected return, which, could hurt you sometimes or could not, but that's investing, right? You really have to think about these things all together. It's a game of averages, right?
All right.
Did you get enough information? You took 11 notes. It's great.
I did.
I didn't hear that anyone loves discretion. I didn't hear that today. Does anyone love the idea of getting comfortable with a strategic partner and working with them for the next 10 years to just outsource this thing?
You mean letting them take the money and do what they want with it?
Yes, perhaps subject to a veto or something like that. I think you specifically said
that. Yeah, you'd still always have veto rights.
Yeah, I'm nervous about that.
Okay. That's fine. That's great. That helps point me in the right direction.
I think it would maybe change over time.
Yeah.
Yes, it could change over time. That could be the case. Although, if we decide to partner with somebody who only works in a non-discretionary fashion, we might not be able to change it to discretionary later. There are some that will offer both.
I just think that if we were to have a really great experience,
yep.
we might
be more comfortable over time.
I
can see that.
Loosening the reins.
Yep.
But I would imagine that at first, there's going to be a fair amount of death grip on the reins.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you're hearing that, right?
That's perfect.
I think we're want to move a little bit
slower. It's already there.
This is exactly why we wanted to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Exactly why.
I think you just have to ease into it.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think is probably what you're saying, Karen.
So, perfect. Chris, do you have enough to bring back a report next month?
I think I do.
Okay. I think so.
Yeah. I think so.
Yep. So we don't need to take
no action required today. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Yeah. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for scaring us.
Yeah.
It is scary.
Top that.
Who is
Ed?
Mind in
this? Scarier. Scarier.
You're on, Ed.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I asked Brian Kwan to join me today. Brian has been working on the account since day one. He's been with Ferris for 5 years?
Almost.
He's been working side by side with me on all of my clients' accounts, and so finally got him to come to my desk. Take a lovely drive across California. So it looks like first on the agenda we have the April flash report. If you have our printed materials, it's behind tab 3. And it's been certainly a volatile first quarter, and that looks like it's continuing into April and May. So the April results, total fund generating net of fees return of 0.6%, calendar year-to-date of 0.72, and fiscal year-to-date of 7.4. So slightly ahead of our actuarial assumption, which is great because we're not done with the year. So hopefully that'll continue. Looking down the column of the monthly performance, we notice some underperformance of capital prospects, which is now continuing for the year-to-date. But fiscal year-to-date, they're nicely ahead of the benchmark there, so not surprising to see them pull back a little bit. Down below that, Fidelity underperforming 1.5 versus 1.7. We'll talk a little bit about them when we take a look at the quarterly report, and everything else performing in line, even on to page 2. Things are looking good for April, and noticeably at about $2.1 billion, just a hair underneath that. So if there are any questions on the April performance report, if not, you can jump into the quarterly review. So the quarterly review, let's start with the quarterly investment landscape behind tab 1. I'll keep this brief. I know you're big fans of three, so I'll keep this.
Absolutely.
Okay, here we go. Page 3, we have our first quarter summary. Quick synopsis here, upper left-hand corner highlights the GDP coming in at 2.2%. So we continue to see this sub 3% economic growth. Point below that is U.S. enacting the tariffs, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, or aluminium if you're British. Portfolio impacts. We lost the eye somewhere. Not to Ellis Island, but I don't know. Portfolio impacts. So economic growth continuing, monetary tightening continuing as well. And it's kind of funny because as we talk about rates rising, and we've had one rate rise this year. We're expecting another in June and maybe another. So we're expecting three in 2018. Our Fed has been tightening monetary policy since 2015. And so it's kind of funny that we're into 2018 and we're talking about this more and more, but that's actually been going on for a while. And so we have a couple charts that we can highlight the activities there. Markets pulling back in the upper right-hand corner. Markets pulling back about 10%. So we finally saw the 10% correction that we always preach is just around the corner. It actually happened in February. And earnings are noticeably strong. The second bullet point there, we'll talk more about that. And some other points. So let's jump ahead to pages 18 and 19. If you open these up at the same time, okay, does that work in terms of how it's bound?
No.
Okay. So 18 and 19 highlight the international trade issue. And on page 18 in the lower left-hand side, you can see our trade balance with several select countries, the biggest countries that we trade with. And you can see how significant the imports and exports difference is with China. And that deficit surplus in orange, almost a negative $400 billion on an annualized basis, and how that compares to the other countries. And you notice that the orange bar, the deficit or surplus, is, you know, pretty darn close to zero. The scale has really changed on this graph because of China. So that's pretty significant. I think that's what the administration is looking at. So whether you like Trump or not, if you're looking at numbers like this, you kind of say, eh, something needs to be done. And if you take a look on the right-hand side, we have it graphed out over time. You see that the top line there that's consistently in positive territory is services. We export services, and we're a service economy, and that kind of makes sense. And the bottom line, the blue line, is the export of goods. And we're negative there, so we're actually importing goods. You can see how that has changed since 1996 through 2008. Just the downward trajectory there of China as China comes online, and other countries, to be fair. And then it kind of flattens out, but if you notice at the very far right, it takes another step down. And so it's not due to the services component, it's due to the goods. So again, something that's probably catching the administration's attention and saying, hey, we can't just let that go by. If you take a look at page 19 on the left-hand side, we map out tariffs. And these are global tariffs. You can see the United States in orange here, 1.6%. So that's our average tariff rate that we are taxing on imports, 1.6%. And you can see how that compares. Relatively modest, directly in line with the European Union, also at 1.6, slightly larger than Japan, Canada at 0.9. But then you take a look at the red bar of China, 3.5, and how that compares. And you look at the countries above that, which of those countries are even developed countries? South Korea is in there. Aside from that, they're much smaller trading partners with much different scenarios, not exactly China's beneficial trade surplus. And so that's also interesting that it catches the attention there. So, yeah, again, something needs to be done, right? But it is interesting because imposing the tariffs on steel and aluminum naturally elicits a response. And so that response is fairly unpredictable in tariff world and politics. So you never know what's going to happen next. And even if we reduce our steel and aluminum tariffs, you don't know if the counterparty will then reduce theirs. So like most of Trump's prior actions, we view this as kind of a bombastic kind of threat to get people interested and to the table, then have a negotiation. And this morning, as we were driving over here, we heard on Bloomberg News reducing China is reducing tariffs on imported automobiles by 15%. So there's some response there. It's interesting to see how that plays out. Generally, I think it's widely held, though, that all economists view trade wars as a problem for full economic growth.
How much of the level of tariffs with respect to China is due to our demand for consumption of electronic goods? I mean, obviously, they would have some leverage over us if we, as a consumer, continue to demand these electronic goods, and something we feel we can't do without. They have some leverage there. How does that affect the tariff rate?
Well, so the tariff is what China's charging tariffs imported into their country.
Oh, okay, I see. Sorry.
So this would be like soybeans or something that we're sending to them. Yeah.
Almonds, exactly.
Right. Pistachios.
If we turn to page 23, this was the slide on monetary tightening that I wanted to highlight, because we took monetary tightening experiences to the U.S. since 1959, and there have only been eight, and we're now in the ninth one. And so this just maps out in the lower left-hand side what happens to real GDP. During the tightening, the green bar, consistently positive through all these past tightening cycles. And that's no surprise, because we're raising rates because the economy's growing. So that kind of makes sense. 12 months after that cycle, we see that there are two situations back in early 80s and then in 04 to 07 where the GDP contracted, but through the other time periods, GDP continued to expand in those next 12 months. Okay, so that's GDP, economic growth. The middle is taking a look at S&P 500 earnings. So during the tightening cycle, we see that earnings consistently have continued to grow, which is what we're seeing now. And 12 months after, there we see a mixed story. Their earnings have come back, and there has been some contraction. So clearly the rising rates are going to hurt corporate earnings. And then we take a look at, okay, so that's earnings, but what happens to actual price appreciation, which we all care about? And we see that during the tightening, all but one of them have increasing price, increasing returns. And then 12 months after, there we see three scenarios where we actually have a pullback and a couple others that are close to zero. So we're kind of in this situation. Everyone is anticipating this recession or whatever. It's been going on for so long. Shouldn't we see a pullback? And what will that do to equity performance? Well, it's inconclusive. It's not saying with clarity that we should experience any one particular outcome. We may continue to enjoy a positive S&P 500 performance. And that gives us a little sigh of relief, I think, in amongst the headlines that we read. And the last thing I'll ask you to turn to is, or second to last, is page 45. We have the S&P 500 sector returns. And so we see here on the left-hand side for the first quarter, just about every sector was negative in terms of performance, except for the top two, information technology and consumer discretionary. And since this information has come out, we've watched the earnings come out on S&P 500 companies for the first quarter. 93% have reported, and the earnings growth is remarkable. 24.5% earnings growth year over year.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Going into the quarter, it's expected to be 17. We expected strong, but wow. And then that's also supported by revenue growth of 8%. So the companies are generating it on the top line as well. And that's actually pretty good news from a valuation perspective because their earnings have come up and prices have kind of stayed level. They haven't continued rising like they were at the beginning of the year. The PE multiple, therefore, has contracted a little bit. So it's about 16 and a half or so.
How much do you think that might be due to a one-time tax impact, though?
Yeah, a big amount.
So we should see that come down in the second quarter.
Yeah, but even second quarter and the rest of 2018 is looking really strong. So it's a big reason why 17 turned into 24, but it's also continuing on past. Or expected to.
But on the stock pricing side, most companies, as data indicates, they use the tax break to buy down their own stocks, buy their own stocks. So the concentration of stocks is now higher, right? And less people have those stocks. So does that impact the price in any way?
It does. So whenever they buy that back, that creates some demand for the stock. So that drives the price up. As a relative proportion of the total float, it's usually really de minimis, and it's done over years. So they'll announce the program, but it won't be implemented tomorrow all at once. And then the other benefit is that then improves earnings per share because there's less shares outstanding, so the earnings help that, and so it's commensurate. And in fact, the math should tie out almost exactly. Investors tend to view things like that or dividends favorably, so it usually has a little bit more of a bump. But mathematically, it should just net out.
But the idea that the tax breaks, the goal was to expand, the operations or, put more money into the system where, you give employees a raise and they will buy more stuff.
Yeah.
That effect doesn't happen if companies just buy back their own stocks, right?
It puts the money in the investors' hands. We would expect to see that trickle through to the economy, but yes, not the way that you're suggesting. So we haven't seen a noticeable uptick in hourly wages or those kind of statistics. So we pay attention to that as a source of potential inflation, and that has just been kind of continuing on as it has been, 0.2% kind of number. So that hasn't really translated. We are seeing increased CapEx, and so it is good to see the companies spending more on property, plant, and equipment kinds of things.
Right.
So CapEx is ticking up, and they are spending it there too. It doesn't get as much headlines, so it's not as exciting. And then page 46, just to wrap up the review of the markets, has the returns for the month, quarter, and year to date in 1, 3, and 5, 10 years. So upper left-hand corner, domestic equities, we see that quarterly column largely in the red by about 1% or 2%, with the exception being the growth stocks, Russell 2000 and Russell 1000. International equities, largely the same, down 1% or 2%. Emerging markets, noticeably positive with 1.4% there. And EM Latin America, positive at 8%. So in the upper right-hand corner, fixed income. This is a little bit surprising, but this is a rising rate environment. So we see some negatives here in this column, particularly longer out on the Treasury curve, greater duration, so a negative 3.3% there. Shorter duration, the 1 to 3 year at a negative 0.2%. in the lower right-hand corner, various other asset classes. So pause there if there are any questions. If not, we can take a look at the review of the pension plan behind tab 2. Okay. And turning to page 1, taking a look at the portfolio reconciliation, starting the quarter at slightly over $2.1 billion. Net cash outflow and net investment change, bringing that down to about slightly under $2.1 billion. Page 2 and 3, highlighting the asset allocation history and where we are currently versus policy. And we see on page 3, on that table in the upper right-hand corner, the no in terms of whether we're within IPS range. So we're currently overweight. This is U.S. large cap equity. We have a 23.6% allocation. Our maximum is 23. Part of that is certainly due to the markets doing well. Part of it is due to the asset allocation, which we'll be discussing momentarily, and whether we should rebalance accordingly. So we'll have that discussion in a moment. Taking a look at performance on pages 4 and 5, 4 gives us the gross of fees performance, and we can compare it to other public plans in the Investor Force database. We can see that for the quarter, down 0.4%, underperforming our index, which was down 0.3%, and fiscal year to date, 6.9%, outperforming policy index at 6.7%. You can see the relative rankings across the various time periods. Looking down the column for the quarter, we see that we had outperformance in U.S. equity, flat, versus the benchmarks down 0.6. We had outperformance in international equity, down 0.7 versus the index at down 1.1. We had outperformance in fixed income. We had outperformance in real estate, direct lending. And then risk parity is where we were down 1.9% versus a blended portfolio at zero. And infrastructure, modest underperformance there as well. Turning to page 6, we have the risk return over the past 5 years, net of fees, my favorite page. Taking a look at how the plan has done, generating annualized return of 8.1%, which is above our actuarial assumption and above our asset allocation expectations, so great news there. And then two columns to the right, we see annualized standard deviation, 5.6%. That's also better than expectations. We would expect that to be about double, more like 12%. So 6% is pretty nice, low-fall environment. And then pages 7 and 8, the only comments I have on our managers are with regard to Fidelity at the bottom of page 7. We see that it underperformed 83rd percentile, and it underperformed fiscal year to date. And so the longer-term track record is now getting to be a bit troubled, though since inception it has outperformed its index, and 10-year has outperformed it, 5-year it has outperformed. This is going through a bit of a transition. We talked to you last quarter about Brian Hosley leaving as of March 31st, Camille Carlstrom taking over, so she is now in place. So we're maintaining a watch attitude with this. We continue to watch it. Historically, this has never been a fund to really shoot the lights out. It's always been around the index, plus or minus, and it's fees for us. So we expect that to continue, but this quarter it underperformed due to some exposure to energy and industrials and materials also helped hurt it. It was underweight emerging markets too, which, as we noted, was the outperforming sector in international equities.
So, Ed, why is, like, the peer review rankings here? I guess that's what they are, right? The third figure in each, under on the international equity, is 70 for MSCI. Then you get LSV, it's 47. Fidelity is 83.
Yes.
That's the peer ranking, correct?
Yes, it is.
In the recent conference in New York, they stressed a lot that if any of the managers are in the bottom 50%, you should really consider, moving on to someone else. Hmm. And many of ours are at that level. So I guess just a thought. That was a couple of the people talked about that back in New York.
That's interesting. That's really.
I had not heard that before at any conference.
Yeah, I've heard it more about bottom decile. Investment managers that are in bottom decile tend to stay in bottom decile.
They're just bottom 10%?
Yeah, bottom 10%. The rest will tend to oscillate. And so the historical bad practice has been that during a period of underperformance, we fire them, we hire the one that's outperforming, and the one that was underperforming recovers, the one that's outperforming goes down, and then everyone's just really regretting their decision. So along those lines, I would ask you to turn to page 40.
One more question on that point, though. I'm curious, was that suggestion made in terms of how to achieve better performance, or was it more of like a fiduciary liability thing, you know, maybe in a defined contribution plan, or you have to not offer underperforming funds, or was it?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Well, a couple times. It was in the evaluation of managers.
Okay.
In one of those breakouts.
Mike, on our deferred comp side, we in our policy, we actually have that if it's in the lower half, 2 quarters in a row in the 3 and 5, that we put them on watch and look to see an improvement. And if we don't get an improvement, then we start looking at whether or not we want to replace that manager with another manager in that sector. Sometimes there just aren't any other managers in that sector.
I got you. No, we've had this discussion at different times over the years.
So if you're on page 40, there's a different performance chart, which I think is really helpful in examining these kinds of issues. The top has the quarterly outperformance, underperformance, and bar, and then the line is the rolling 3-year performance. And so you can see that 3-year number has trended over time. And this looks a lot like every other active manager out there. It goes through its period of outperformance, which we see back in Q1 13. We see it come down in Q1 to Q2 of 14. We see it come back up in 15, 16, and now coming back down. And so this is kind of that oscillation that this is why. As long as the people and process and everything that generated the returns is still in place, we would expect it to change, to go through this. If they're changing things like that, then we want to take a more careful look at it. And so they do have the change in PM, so we are taking a more careful look at it. But I don't know that it's time to pull the trigger yet. So we'll continue to watch. If we jump back to page 11, this has your closed-end funds and the progress of capital commitments, which we can see now that most of these are fairly highly called. So just kind of tagging on to Chris's presentation about the next steps with the private markets program, part of it is certainly due to this, is that these are now rather mature investments, and to continue building this program, we'll need to start thinking about the next investments as these start to kick off their final cash flows to us, etc. And then page 12 has the actual performance. And so here on the furthest right-hand side, this is the IRR date. This is the statement date from the manager. And the column to the left of that, Stansera, parentheses and close parentheses, is the net of fees performance for Stansera. So this is the IRR. So you can see here Greenfield Gap at 15.1%, your direct lending much lower than that, and then infrastructure doing quite well so far. And then page 14 has the fee schedule across the publicly traded managers. Strategies. Those are my prepared remarks on the performance of the plan. The next agenda topic, 7C, is the asset allocation. Rick, I know you had a cover memo to it, and I'm going to ask Brian to cover that part of the presentation for us.
Let me just really quick, I'll kick this off. This is item 7C. It's a discussion and action item. Staff's recommendation to you today will be to approve alternative asset mix B,
authorize Veris to initiate an emerging manager search for the debt allocation contingent upon the approval of Mix B, and update the asset allocation in Stansair's investment policy statement to reflect the revised asset allocation. Mr. Kwan.
Thanks, Rick. So behind four, page two, there's a slide titled Executive Summary. A lot of this is repeating essentially what Rick said. But we're looking at this because for our IPS, we're going to review this annually, take into account new capital market assumptions, take another look at the liquidity program, which Rick did, and make small tweaks around the edges. So the goal is not to make large changes, but to make small tweaks to see if we can build a slightly more efficient portfolio and put things a little bit more in favor of updated information that we have. So with that, I'll get into the mixes here and turn to page four. So slide title, asset allocation, working from the left all the way to the right, we have the different asset classes that we're currently investing in or proposing investing in. And starting with the very left column, we have our current portfolio. So this is the portfolio allocation as at the end of the first quarter, which Ed just covered in his presentation. To the right of that is phase one targets. So these are the current, more shorter term targets that we have. So these are the targets that we are focused on as we build out the private markets program and eventually evolve to what's the next column over called long-term targets. So long-term targets was a policy that was approved April of 2017, and that's where we will eventually get to as we build out our private markets program. And then two to the right of that, alternative mixes A and B. These two are pretty similar in a lot of senses. And they make small tweaks from the long-term targets. The most notable change you'll see there is a reduction in large cap equity, the very top line there, and then slight tilts into international equity and small tweaks around the edges there. Mix B is our recommendation. The main difference between Mix A and Mix B is an allocation to emerging market debt, which is in Mix B. So that's a total allocation of 4%. You see 2% allocated to emerging market debt hard, and another one to local. So the difference between hard and local is the currency. Hard would be debt issued in dollar terms, so we wouldn't be taking any of that currency risk. So a lot of times when you invest internationally, you're investing in the local currency over there. If the US dollar appreciates or depreciates, when you convert it back to US dollars, that has an impact on your profit. Local is saying we're gonna go ahead and invest in local terms and take that conversion back. Based on what direction the US dollar moves, currency exposure can be a tailwind or a headwind. So what we would ultimately propose here is a blended strategy where the allocation goes to a single manager, and they're the ones who analyze the currency markets, and they move between hard and local currency. And our research has found that they're able to add some value there, or at least manage some of the risk associated with that. Currency markets are complicated, and you know, if we make an allocation directly to one, we may be taking additional risk or maybe missing out on some opportunities versus the other one. So a blended approach is what we would recommend here. But for modeling purposes, we're showing you 2% in each. This is one allocation to one manager, most likely. Page five shows the output of those mixes. And you'll see to the right, mixes A and B. The changes are at the margin, but they are slight improvements from the long-term target. So Mix A has a 10-year forecast return of 6.6, whereas Mix B has 6.5. The forecast 10-year real return, which takes into account inflation, our inflation assumptions are 2.1%. That is 4.5 for Mix A and 4.4 for Mix B. Actuarial assumed rate of return is 7.25. Their inflation assumption is 3%, so that real return is 4.25. So we're slightly above from real return perspective or actuarial assumed rate, but these things aren't exactly precise, so for all intents and purposes, we're mostly there. And the standard deviation, which is the risk in the portfolio, Mix A is the same as the long-term targets that we're currently at, and Mix B is a slight improvement there, standard deviation moving down 0.3. And then below that are various scenario analyses of different environments that we would forecast based on these allocations.
Maybe I misunderstand this. Under alternative B, our emerging market investment is 25%. The international development market is 20%. So No, I'm sorry, so it's a total of 25, and then there's four more that we add to that and make it 29, because the emerging market debts are actually overseas also.
Yeah, so internationally, outside of the U.S., it would be a total of 29%. 25% of that would be in the form of equity, stocks. 4% of that would be in the form of debt. And most of this debt is debt purchase from emerging market governments that they issue. The return versus traditional fixed income in developed markets, U.S., Western Europe and whatnot, in emerging markets, their rates tend to be higher, so we get a higher return there. Their balance sheets tend to be a little bit healthier, and there is a diversification benefit. They are emerging economies, so the risk is also a little bit higher, but in compensation for that risk, the expected return is also higher.
So it's, but it's 29% in
outside the U.S.
non-American.
Exactly.
And the challenge we face is really the three columns to the right. As you look down the return column, trying to generate a portfolio that gives us a 7-ish kind of return target is pretty hard to do. Here in the U.S., when you take a look at U.S. large cap, just the top line, to pick one, 4.5%, that number is based on the forecast expectations that are built off dividend yield, which is about 2%, earnings growth, which is a little under 2%. Inflation, which is around 2%. Valuation correction, which actually detracts 1.5% to 2%. And so you add those up and you get to this 4.5% number. So over the next 10 years, we're looking at U.S. equities generating about a 4.5% return. Now maybe that number's right, maybe it's wrong, who knows, but that's using the building block assumptions in that manner, it is pretty sound over time. And so when we take a look at it, we say, okay, that's what U.S. gives us. The standard deviation, 15.7, that's historically how much the stock prices in the U.S. have varied. So 15.7 annualized standard deviation is a lot for a pension plan to stomach. And then the Sharpe ratio is just kind of a comparison of return to risk. So it's really a function of those two. So we do that for each asset class, and you build it out, and you say, okay, so where do the opportunities exist? Well, if we want to build something that's in excess of 6.5% or 7%, we have to look to the international markets, developed and emerging. We have to look at value-add real estate and infrastructure. We have to look at private equity is slightly under 6.4. Private credit is slightly under 6.9. But those two are both additive, particularly private credit that has a really low standard deviation. Risk parity at 7.2, that's beneficial. So we have to think about how we add those things in. And once we add those things in, trying to build a diversified portfolio that has downside protection, that has liquidity, that has all the other constraints we're wrestling with, is where we end up with alternative mixes A and B, or you know, current long-term and the results.
I'd see that these are fairly mainstream assumptions. I mean, they compare with other things that I've seen out there. And I agree, it's a very hard problem to get a 7% portfolio.
Well, maybe that's the problem. Maybe we're reaching for something that's not achievable.
That's a good.
It could be.
Good question.
Could be.
Very much
maybe
so.
Maybe 7.25% or 7.5% is not realistic. The budget, looking at this, to get out of U.S. equities and go into emerging markets, I think it's the wrong direction to go.
You know, at the
economies look good to me, and small caps are doing better than large caps. And these communist countries, you know, that don't want to loan money to the emerging markets, they're like poor investment. They're nothing I put my money into.
One of the funnier parts of the conference was talking about China. And what they said about China was, you can't trust the data. You cannot trust the data from, because their national government over there, they give, you know, goals and that all the provinces have to reach, and then that goes into their countrywide numbers. And they got, and people just said, you can never trust the data that comes up from the provinces because they're all, that data is designed to meet the goal the government assigned them. And so then the people who are urging investment in China gave a speech, and we asked the question, what about all these people who say you can't trust the data? They said they're correct. You've got to get a manager who's on the ground, who knows the stuff in China. And that kind of applies to all of the stuff that's out of the normal viewing of the people here. So, like when we talk about, you know, the debt, you know, the high risk debt in emerging markets, you know, somebody's got to tell us whether that's good or bad, or somebody just passing, you know, filling the quota number.
That's right. That's right. And it would be active managers that we would look to and look at their capabilities around the world, look at their track record for sure, and get their views. And you'll hear that emerging market debt, we aren't recommending indexing that because we think the index that gets exposure to all those countries is naive. And if you roll up your sleeves and do some research, you can figure out a better way of investing. And so we look at managers that do that. So I think Brian was talking earlier about looking at the manager that has a balance of blend of hard and local currency exposure, having that blend. They make that decision. You know, when we hear like Venezuela issuing in dollar terms, that might sound great. It's taking currency risk off the table for us, except that they bear the currency risk. And so if they can't repay in dollar terms, then it's going to go default anyhow. So you have to be smart about analyzing that credit exposure of can Venezuela pay its bills, whether it's in hard or local terms. And so they, the managers do that, and that's why we think it's worthy of your consideration. Is that
you're not going to bring Venezuela to us, are you?
Not now.
But Argentina comes in and out of the financial markets every 7 to 10 years, too. I mean, until they default. I mean, this is a thing. I mean, and this is part of, that's why the manager is there to manage those risks, to analyze them, to try to determine when it's worth it to take that risk.
So
that's part of it.
The international developed countries, they have a good track record, though, right? I mean, how's their history looking like?
Oh, it's as
they're better. Yeah.
But the rates are low. That's the German or European bonds don't pay anything.
The valuations haven't experienced what we have here in the U.S. So throughout 2017, we continued to push through new high, even into early 18, and now we're slightly off of that. They are just now touching new high kind of territory. So when you put the charts side by side, you're like, oh my gosh. And so the valuations are that different. We apply the same model from a building blocks approach. Show me what your dividend yield is. Show me what your earnings growth is. Show me what your inflation is. Build those things together. Take a look at where valuations are to come up with that assumption. Same approach used international developed in the U.S. large cap are creating these numbers, and you can see how different the results are.
Right.
Can you touch maybe on page 5, the fifth row in the table? I think there's an interesting statistic, this fifth percentile number you talked about, the negative numbers there.
Okay.
Yeah, so in running the analysis, this is basically the type of drawdown that we would expect in the 5 percentile row. So you can think of it as another 1 in 20 years type of thing.
So alternative MSB has the lowest drawdown under this scenario, the negative 8.8, which I assume the emerging market debt is partly responsible for.
Partly, yes, among other tweaks.
Exactly.
So that's a statistical analysis based on the volatility of the portfolio, how bad it could look. The other ways that we look at it are with regard to pages 9 and 10 and 11. 9 and 10 give you historical scenarios, and saying, okay, how would that portfolio perform back then? And you can see it in up and down markets. And generally, you're seeing mixes A and mix G have more muted responses, not as much downside, not as much upside. And then stress testing on page 11 is just a hypothetical. What if U.S. dollar appreciated 20%? What if global equities corrected 20%? Spreads rose 100 basis points and rates rose 100 basis points, and you can see what would happen in each of those two. So we kind of beat up the portfolios in a couple different ways to understand what is our downside risk look like. How bad can bad be?
Do we actually approve emerging market debt as a class?
That's up to you today.
Do you have it in here as?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I know I got that.
So if you approve, well, whichever mix you approve, we would update the investment policy statement accordingly. With regard to something like emerging market debt, we would treat it as one line item, emerging market debt, and not call out the hard and local, and give it a range of, well, so if this is a target of 4%, probably 0 to 8 or something like that. So that would then give us time to be in compliance with the policy while we go and do the next steps in terms of education or search or whatever needs to be done to actually fulfill the mandate.
So the short-term government credit, you're proposing 2%, you know, from 18 to 20?
Yes.
To address Jim's concern, you know, can the change come from the short-term credit rather than the equity? You know, the change that we're trying to find in the emerging market. What does that do if it were to come from short-term government credit rather than the U.S. domestic equity?
Oh, so if we, for example, took 2% from short-term gov credit and put it in domestic equity or something like that?
Right, or maintain the U.S. Domestic equity where it is.
Yeah. So we looked at that, and the results were that the forecasted return goes up modestly, the risk goes up more, and so the net impact, like the Sharpe ratio, goes down.
Okay.
So it's not as an efficient portfolio.
Yeah, the beautiful thing about the short-term gov credit, if you look at the standard deviation column, it's an order of magnitude below anything else on the page. That's really serves as a nice dampener.
Well, what's the return on the short-term government credit?
It's low. It's 2.5. Yeah, that's right.
2.5.
You want to increase the next to nothing return from 18% to 20%? I look at this thing here, and I just think we're absolutely going in the wrong direction by changing the asset allocation at this time. Now, I'm no expert in this, but it looks like the wrong thing to do, and I'm not going to be able to support it. I just think we're the domestic equity is already too low, and to go down even less and go into something like an emerging market is, to me, it's an attractive investment.
It doesn't
look right to me. I don't feel good about this at all.
One of the issues you need to consider, though, is your fiduciary responsibility here, because the more money you have, if you don't choose one of the portfolios that's before you, in front of you, then it could be that what you think is better is actually a portfolio that produces more risk than what these portfolios do overall. So you have to be very careful about these types of judgment calls in terms of the risk that are associated overall with the portfolio.
Yeah, but we just had an hour-long discussion about 10% allocation in the private equity, and we had no idea of the different things that are in it.
Right.
And that's somewhere in this.
It is. It's in the mix.
Which one is it?
It's the third line. Private equity, and then private credit is further down.
So we don't even know what that is. My problem with the formulas is that it tends to be treated as a Bible.
Yep.
It's like a religious dictate that you have to meet certain percentages, and I don't think that's, since it isn't the Bible, I don't think it's always right. That was for the public.
I don't know, that's my feeling. Sure, you can give short-term debt with a 2% return and increase it to 20%, they want to really lower the risk down. I don't think domestic equity, especially large cap, is a risky thing to be invested in.
I guess it does kind of stand out. Ed, would you say a 10% U.S. large cap equity is mainstream or common among public pension plans? Do you have a sense?
You have some comparisons not too far away.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I know in endowment world for sure that's very.
And the private equity is largely U.S., so that's why we're showing that in domestic equity. The question there is really public versus private.
Okay.
And if you're getting the illiquidity premium, call it, then why wouldn't you? You can take advantage of that. And having the allocation to short-term credit allows you to do that from a total portfolio construction.
Yeah, I agree. Okay.
But why would we be going all the way to alternative mix B instead of our phase one targets?
Well, phase one target is an interim step towards the long-term target. So that's only there because we know it's taking time to fund the private markets. So you can see private equity there is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Private credit is five, which is basically where we're at. And we were saying, okay, well, we want to have an interim target knowing it's going to take years to get to the long-term target. Now what we're doing is saying, okay, based on updated capital market assumptions, are there any tweaks we can make to the long-term target to improve it? So we're saying, yeah, there are some tweaks, and that's what A and B offer. I mean, they aren't dramatically different. Yes, it's a reduction on the domestic equity side, an uptick in international equity side, introduction of EMD and alt mix B.
But it's a departure from where we were headed. You know, we were headed towards long-term targets, and it's a departure from where we thought we were going.
Yeah, long-term target had a growth portfolio of 64%, and the alternatives have 63. So where you allocate the 64 and 63 is based on where valuations have changed. 2017 was a pretty dramatic year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the returns, we don't want to just say, oh, okay, no big deal. We want to incorporate that into the analysis and say, all right, based on those returns, you know, what do we see the U.S. generating for us going forward? Well, it's not as much as it has been. We actually realized a lot of them in 2017. If we saw, you know, much more muted returns going forward, are probably merited. And so you just kind of follow that line of analysis across the other asset classes. Big picture, liquidity portfolio going from 19 to 21. Big picture, risk diversifying going from 17 to 16. I think a little more is tweaks, 1% of where you're allocating.
I understand your point.
Okay.
However, I think it's hard to make that 90-degree turn. It's a little easier to steer the ship more slowly.
More gradually. Well, okay. So when you say 90-degree turn,
what were our returns this first quarter? What were corporate returns?
Corporate.
Yeah.
Public equity.
Yeah.
Like 20%.
24%.
I think that's playing into a perception that.
U.S. equity down 0.6% in the first quarter?
No, I mean, weren't we talking about corporate returns and,
yes,
and so
yes,
on?
Yes, yes, yes.
And I think that plays into a perception that domestic equities are really safe and a good choice, as opposed to the old, you know, eggs in the basket issue.
Gotcha. Yes. And price accordingly.
Right. So where do we go from here? Right. I mean, if you believe these CMAs, if they're at all accurate, it makes a lot of sense to go to be weighted more towards international equities, doesn't it?
So along those lines, when we take a look at U.S. large cap, we say, where are prices today? We look at that pricing valuation in two respects. One is the trailing PE, so the past 12-month PE, and the Shiller PE, which is a cyclically adjusted 10-year averaging cycle. Both of those are showing that it's roughly in the high 80 to 90th percentile, meaning that we're that expensive here in the U.S. And when we see that we're that expensive in the U.S., then the next 10 years, expecting it to come down to median, so expecting that PE multiple to come back to average, not even into like correction territory where they would be cheap, just coming back to average, brings them down a full point and a half over 10 years. So a point and a half per year over 10 years. That's a key driver of why we're seeing returns at 4.5. So we do, you know, we want to collect the dividends. Yep. We want to see the earnings continue to grow. Yep. We want to see a low inflation environment. And because of that price correction, even that adds in here, and you get that 4.5. So it's, the earnings are in there, and so is the price, and these two things are working together.
Is there a is there a version to mix B because of the emerging market debt? And if so, is alternative mix A a better, a more palatable solution here? Is that an issue?
It is for me.
Could you support mix A?
My issues, as you're aware, are more fundamental. I don't, and I've often spoken here about our rush to outside of borders with investment money, and I find that to be a riskier course than within this home country, where we're familiar with the laws and the process and the transparency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't object to well-researched investments overseas in any country, except possibly Venezuela. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I don't think we have to do offshore investments just because. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the trade-off is, though, is that we're going to be earning more, right?
That's the bet.
So then are we going to be earning our 7.25? So then if we're choosing to stay within the U.S., then don't we need to reevaluate that 7.25?
Precisely.
And if we evaluate that, then our unfunded liability goes up, the employers have to pay more into it, so there's all those other impacts.
That may have to be reevaluated regardless of how we invest.
I'm just saying those are the other impacts.
But we, Rick, this is for you, but we do know that if we don't go with B, the statement in your paragraph that this is an expected real return that keeps us in line with our current actual discount rate is no longer valid, correct?
No, it would still be valid on our long-term target because you would add 90 basis points to each of those numbers at the very top, and that would be the expected rate of return, the expected assumed rate of return. So if we kept our long-term target, let me explain this a little more so you understand what I'm saying. Verus assumes a 2.1% inflation return. Our long-term actuarial projection for inflation is 3%. So that's a 90 basis point difference. So you would just simply add 90 basis points to all those numbers on the top row to get your expected actuarial assumed rate of return. So if we stuck with the long-term targets, we would still be at 7.3%, which is above the 7.25. We'd still be hitting that bogey. My concern, I think, more lies in the fact that if you decide to stick with the current targets, we're looking at a lower expected rate of return with the same risk. That troubles me.
So you're saying that the risk is the same then with our long-term targets? What's being proposed here in these alternative mix.
Actually, the risk is higher on our long-term target for mix B, if you look at the standard deviation as the measure of risk in the portfolio. So it troubles me that we would want to stick with the long-term target. I would rather take your suggestion, and Mike's suggestion over here is that if that's the case, then we relook at the assumed rate of return and adjust our portfolio after we do that. I don't think it's a viable option to stick on the current target given the change in capital market expectations. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a viable option. I don't think it's a prudent option on your part, on this entire board's part. And if you do, then you are negating the analysis and the capital market expectations that the professionals have brought to us. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, the risk component is really important for a pension plan just because whenever the market corrects, you still have to pay out the benefit payments and expenses. So when it recovers, you have less capital there to enjoy the recovery. So statistically, a plan might look good or a portfolio mix might look good. In terms of an actual cash flow basis, when you model it out or when your actuary models it out, that correction and then paying out of expenses actually causes more than the more than this kind of return number. So we're showing, you know, a couple different ways. The fifth percentile return, negative 9.2, negative 8.8 kind of number is how that plays out.
Right. The only reason I brought the comments up was just to look at the whole picture of what's being discussed, not voicing an opinion, but just saying if that's what we're looking at.
Well, this doesn't happen overnight. So what is the, you know, we clearly aren't prepared to vote to allocate the $250 million on
the private markets.
We're not prepared to do that.
Right.
So that money's not going to be shifted, you know, overnight. We're not prepared to invest in the emerging market debt, are we? I mean, are we?
No.
So
what would the timing be on the?
Is that the board's pleasure as a group?
No. I'm not suggesting that we adopt the quotas. Mm-hmm. But I don't see why that should stop the exploration of what you want
right.
to do. And I'm even open to talking about emerging debt, but I got a lot of convincing to do. Were you thinking of switching, you know, just transferring money from domestic equities to international markets, like $300, $400 million next week? I mean, what's the
plan? You know, if this is adopted, I don't think we'd have to come up with a plan for how we're going to put that money to work.
Okay, but see, the problem is if you adopt the plan,
yep.
the quotas, then you all of a sudden have to fill it only
you,
in this niche.
You do, that's right.
Yeah, and then, you know, you don't look at other niches. That's the issue I have.
Right, but most of these are kind of tweaks here. The big changes are the emerging market debt. That's 4%, and that's not something that we would go into immediately. But the rest are pretty small tweaks if you look at the agenda cover sheet.
Well, no, it's 50% reduction in U.S. large debt.
Yeah.
But we're already on the – see, I think what you're looking at, though, is we're already on a target of 16% large cap, so we're reducing that by 6%. This is
right.
where we are, but we're
right.
heading to this right,
right.
here.
So
yeah.
So you're saying we're already taking
mm-hmm.
7% off, and then additional 7, I'm going to take another
correct.
6.
Correct, yeah. Correct. Yeah.
You know, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, and we haven't even managed to get to the 16.
That's right.
Right. We've been holding extra there because we know private equity hasn't been in the portfolio
right.
yet, so it's a proxy sort of.
I would make the comment, you know, that going from 16% to 10% is not a 6% decrease. It's about 40% decrease.
On a relative basis.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've got a lot of differences in opinion here, but I just think this thing is the wrong direction.
Board members, what is your sentiment here? Donna?
So, I'm fine with emerging markets. In fact, you know, to be perfectly honest, I have emerging markets in my own personal mutual funds. That said, it's not money that the amount I have in it is not substantial.
Right.
But I don't think 4% is substantial either. I mean, as a percentage of the overall portfolio. I mean, 96% of it is not in that. And so for
that's
me,
just the debt section.
It's less of an issue.
Okay.
On the other hand, you know, when you're talking about emerging markets and they're getting 100% return, it went from $2 to $4, you know. I don't have a problem with the emerging markets, but...
What, do you want to... make a motion today on one of these alternatives? Are you that far along?
So, I would be comfortable with it, but what I see is a lot of empty chairs. And we have other people who will have opinions about it as well. Darren's going to have opinions.
Jeff.
Michael's going to have opinions. Jeff's definitely going to have an opinion. And I hate to make a long-term move like this without all the parties at the table.
I want
everyone to have had a vote on that before we made that decision.
So you're not prepared to vote today?
I'm not prepared to.
Sam?
I'm looking at the staff recommendations, and I like one and two. Three, I would, if we were to do an up-down vote, I would say let's hold off until we find an emerging manager. If we never find one, and then we make the change to our policy before we find one, we're sort of stuck. Or we're making changes again to our policy. What if we don't find a manager we like? I anticipate that when Varis goes out and looks for a manager, we're going to vet them very seriously. And they may come to this table, and we don't like what we see. And then we're back to, now what do we do? So,
but do we want to spend that time looking for somebody if we're not going to go there?
Yeah, we usually set asset allocation first, so we have direction to then initiate the search and conduct it in that way. What we would do to mitigate your concern would be to say, put the band around it from like a 0 to 8%. And so if you're at 0% because you're in that search process and nothing comes up, you haven't violated your policy, you're in line with that, you're probably not going to hit the numbers that you're looking at, but it's not.
But to address your concern about time, we're extending this to allow other members to have a say. Why not give us more time? So
you're, Sam, you would wait till next month to approve this item?
I'd be willing to table it.
Okay. Mandy, what is your preference?
You know, I particularly don't have a problem with emerging markets or international equity. I do, though, you know, I have a feeling that maybe the domestic U.S. equity, the new target of 10% is low. But then, I'm a risk taker, but so I'm like, you know, why not use the short-term government credit to fund some of the other stuff?
Gotcha.
But then that does something to the risk. It creates a high risk of portfolio.
Would you want this item to be continued to next month so the full board can participate?
Yeah.
Lauren?
I don't have a problem with the international investments. I also have personal investments. We live in a global world. The reality of our world these days, as long as those international investments are safe, then I don't have a problem with it. I was thinking the same thing before Donna voiced it. We do have some significant members that are not here, so I do think it would be better if we tabled it until everyone was here.
Supervisor?
No, I think we should table it. I mean, I'm prepared to vote against it today, but I haven't heard anything here from these guys that convinces me to reduce U.S. equity by 40%. I just think they're just wrong on this. You know, I could be wrong, too, but I just, you know, my gut feeling is this thing is your targets and your advice. I don't value it a bit on this. Usually I do, but not on
this. I think we're just really exposed. If we have another big dip in the market, another big correction, that overweighting to large cap equities, I think it could be a real risk if something goes sideways. That's my big concern with being so overweight and above our target, is it just creates for me a sense that we're at risk.
Could I have a motion to table this item until next month?
I'll make that motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Call the roll.
Lauren Klein?
Yes.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Mandeep Dhillon?
Yes.
Okay. There'll be a... Okay, we'll keep going.
Right. Is there any need to look at an alternative mix C, or are we good to come back together?
I think you guys should bring this report back, but I
same
think
thing.
Okay.
The month.
Yep.
Talking to the individual board members.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, including me.
Yep.
All right. Next, we have another item.
We move on to administrative.
Hopefully we'll have everybody at their chairs by tomorrow.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You normally say that.
Yeah, go ahead. Tim is coming back.
So, okay, I'm sorry. So this is item 8A. This is the Information Technology Solutions Project Update. This will be presented by Don. And if I don't get back in time, item 8B is going to be the Boardroom Committee Update, which will be presented by Natalie Elliott. And I promise I'll be back for 8C.
Okay.
Okay. Go, guys, go.
This one will be short and sweet, I promise. Our IT project is going very well, and we are still on time and on budget, which at this point in the game, I think is just incredible. So I'm really proud of everybody. You've heard that we are working with the employers to make sure that we're going to be able to have the uploads of the contributions and the information that we need from them. We are working, staff are working diligently on getting information on the calculators. So all the different kinds of calculators to calculate interest, contributions, estimates, all kinds of retirements, all the different death benefits and everything. We are also working on buybacks. That's the other one. We're working on the getting all the different types of buyback figured out as well. So we've got staff working to get all of this information together, and then on top of that, they're reading all the documents that come, and then they are also spending their time in there testing everything that we've received so far. Every time we find a bug, we send it back, they fix it, and when it comes back, we have to retest. So we've got a lot of testing going on, too. So we've got an awful lot of staff time going into this right now, and they are just doing a fantastic job. I couldn't be more proud of them.
Excellent. And the board, I think, is really confident in the work that you guys are doing on that. I mean, it's kind of like you get a blank check. Well, within reason.
Yeah, there we go.
That's 8C.
Yeah, no.
Okay, boardroom.
Okay, 8B, boardroom committee update. At last month's board meeting, the board approved a budget of between $200,000 and $330,000 to do the boardroom tenant improvements in the larger area next to us. A committee was formed with Rhonda, Jeff, Jim, and Michael, and the committee met on May 1st with Teeter Inc., the design architect. Teeter went over the original plans with the committee and explained what was done up to this point. The committee is leaning towards having the finishes be similar to the office to minimize costs, the front office counter and things like that, rather than the dark, rich, dark wood look like the board supervisor's boardroom has. The dais design and the floor plan will remain the same. We'll be using the same flooring that we have. Teeter came in and measured everything and determined that none of the lighting needed to be redone, so that's good news. But the heating and air ducts will be updated to facilitate the airflow and improve our office airflow for that matter. So the next meeting is May 31st, and hopefully we'll have final construction documents presented to the committee at that time.
Excellent. Any comments from members? Good job. What's the last item? The budget?
Budget.
The fun one.
No, you can't have any money. No money for you.
You want me to go on without everybody?
He said he'd be back for it.
Okay.
On the other hand.
Fiscal year 18-19 proposed administrative budget.
You guys want to do, until he gets back, want to do member comments?
Sure.
Sam, you have any member comments?
Sure. You can do it. Went to NC PERS, I'm sure a few of us went, and ESG seemed to be a big topic everywhere, the environmental, social, and governance. It seemed like no matter what presentation you went to, it was the word that was slipped in at every single presentation. How that's going to impact us, I don't know. It seems like some boards were taking an active position and others were just responding to how the companies and different funds that they were investing in were offering services. Went to one and they were showing that they were making the returns prior to the change. So they were showing that they could be more environmentally friendly, more diverse on their boards, and still make the money for their investors. So it was really, really interesting. I was in there when you asked about the China question, and they said, don't trust the big macro data. You gotta dig into these companies. Yeah. And that you'll find when you start looking at the books and other things, you'll know which companies are doing right and which ones are sort of propped up by the government. And then there was one in one of the presentations, and I didn't do enough reading into our bylaws, but how are we gauging our effectiveness as a board? What tool are we using to gauge effectiveness? And I felt I needed to do a little more reading, but it was one of the questions that I was asked at two of the presentations, and it was part of the whole ESG package that they were looking at governance now of the boards as just as important as your return. So very good. It was a very good all of them I enjoyed. It was nonstop from the minute you got in there till when they let you out. So it was very good. That's it.
Thanks. Donna, you want to make some comments? We're going to do public member comments before his last report.
If we were to move to social investing, I would like to recommend my personal preferences as the guideline to the whole board.
I will second some of those.
We can vote on.
I think that's the problem with it, with the social investing, is that what my social preferences and environmental preferences are not necessarily yours, and that it would be impossible to meet everybody's needs.
No, it was really, though, that was an interesting, meeting people from different states that had actual state mandates that required them to divest from certain things. They didn't have a choice. It was just when I was sitting at the tables listening to them, and then asking them how they were meeting their
San Francisco is a nightmare.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
And do you have member comments?
Yes, I do. Just to add to Sam's comments, there's also a lot of talk about, you know, defined benefit plans in general. You know, there's some risk, you know, there's some legislation that's being introduced all over the nation about, you know, making them go away and become more like a defined contribution type system, or some hybrid of it. So a lot of conversation about that, and also on, you know, how it's valuable that we have a voice, that we can, as pension plans can affect how a corporation behaves, because, you know, our numbers, the investments are so large when you pull them together. For example, they were able to get some Wells Fargo to settle, you know, for a huge amount. I don't know if it was like a class action by a whole bunch of, I wasn't clear on how all that was done, but to instill good behavior on corporations, Fox News, you know, not Fox News per se, but Fox the company, you know, this the Me Too movement, you know, all that issues about sexual harassment and how they were able to get a huge settlement from them too that affected, when it made public, I mean, the stock prices came down, and so the systems were able to fight back and get some of that back. And as a result, how these boards are now making sure that you know, governments of these companies, as you know, in addition to investment holdings, that they're socially responsible. So that was another angle that I took. And also is, you know, in a 401k type of system, defined contribution, we don't have much say, you know, on because it's pooled so many different ways. Like as individuals, we can't enforce, you know, how a company behaves. We just take what they have, and there's no voice that way. Plus, there's also the benefits of a defined contribution is there's hardly any savings. You know, if you don't have that, then likely you'll have a large amount of people on public charge anyway. So how does that help, you know, in the long run? So those are some of my takeaways. It was a great action-packed, you know, 5 days for me. One other thing, you know, some systems have a way of evaluating the trustees. So that was something new. Like a formal evaluation.
Next.
So, yeah, it was a good deal.
You know, I'd like to just follow up. New York's very expensive, more expensive than I anticipated. And I don't know if in future conferences, should we continue to go there, there'd be consideration to the per diem specifically for that, because you can only eat at those food carts so many days before you just stop eating.
I was just saying that to myself this morning. I took a beating on this New York trip, personally.
And it was just average, nothing...
Yep.
Nothing but basic food.
Yep.
We follow the county guidelines there, don't we?
Yes.
We do, yeah.
They don't have New York.
They don't have New York. In the
yeah. So
MSA,
that,
GSA.
Yeah, they've got the taco stand down in McHenry or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
GSA.
So, Lauren, do you have comments?
No.
No comments. Supervisor. I was, just very quickly, I was in New York also. It was a great conference. The NC PERS has their website is up. And they, their conference site, and all the documents that we saw, most of them are on that site too. And so it's easy to follow. You're right about the governance. That was that's the governance issue and the issue of transparency kind of dominated a lot of the discussion. And the one thing that I, you know, they had the speaker at lunch. I think it was the last lunch, maybe the day before the last day, was the Harvard Law School roommate of the newest Supreme Court Justice. And he was talking about the corporation labor alliance. And I asked a question about how's that going to work out when they do the Janus decision, you know, any day now, right? Which essentially removes public employee funding of ballot initiatives, et cetera, et cetera. And he didn't answer the question. But, he says there's going to be a new partnership between corporations and labor. So, interesting. Hopefully he's correct. So, that's with that, you know, that's the member
okay.
section is done, and you're the last item.
Thank you. So, this is item 8C. This is the fiscal year 2018-2019 proposed administrative budget, and this is a discussion and action item. Staff's recommendation today would be to approve the recommended proposed administrative budget for fiscal year 2018-2019. This agenda item is being presented by Natalie Elliott.
There are just a few items I want to highlight on the budget. It's a pretty long document, so a lot of numbers, and I could spend another hour here going over that thing. So. Just a couple items of interest. We are requesting approval for a little over $6.6 million again this year. 43% of this budget is technology related, and the bulk of that is the new pension administration system. So for salaries and benefits, we are under budget due to two employees leaving Stansera at the end of the prior fiscal year, leaving two positions empty for almost the entire year. And the investment officer position, which was approved the prior fiscal year, was not filled until January of this fiscal year. We are over budget in the technology section. The hosting fees for the Rivas imaging system started earlier than we expected, so those increased those expenditures. Nor were we expecting to lose our IT person, which caused an additional cost for IT consulting services. So those are the two main things that increased that, those expenditures, and caused us to be over budget. All the other budget categories are under budget for the 17-18 fiscal year. And the capital projects budget includes the amount approved by the board for the boardroom tenant improvements as stands there as last month's meeting. And it also includes Stan Sarah's share to upgrade the security in the 12th Street building lobby, as well as projected costs of the pension administration system for just the 18-19 fiscal year. Things to note are that Stan Sarah doesn't actually appropriate funds to pay expenses each year. The budget starts with fresh numbers rather than us flowing new numbers or remaining numbers, rolling them over to the next fiscal year. So going forward, though, because the pension administration system hopefully will be almost fully implemented in fall of 2019, for starting in the 19-20 fiscal year, these budget requests should start decreasing.
I was just going to ask you what the, so for 19-20, is there going to be more capital expenditures for IT, or is this pretty much the last year?
Pretty much last year with a little residual.
Yeah.
Thank you. Very good report.
Natalie, just a question. Natalie, I was just curious on the county support services.
Mm-hmm.
There was an 80% increase in auditor expenses from 10,000 to 18,000, and then in CEO personnel, a 50% increase from 10 to 15,000.
Those are cap charges. No charges.
Okay.
Those are given to them.
Yeah, okay. I didn't see any charge increasing by 80% other than that one. So I was curious.
I was provided the cap charges from the auditor's office, and those are the numbers I used for this little piece of it.
When they send out the budget numbers to us, they just send us the cap charges.
Okay.
Sam, what you need is a probation charge.
We did add two staff, so that's part of it.
Okay.
So all the costs increased.
I know it's minimal, but it just stood out as I was looking at numbers.
Okay, is there a motion?
I'll make that motion to accept the budget.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to support the fiscal year budget for the administration at Stan Sarah. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Fred, we don't have a executive session.
No.
This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.